This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Mr. Richard Marks on the 27th of August, 2002, approximately 9:10 Lubbock time. I'm in the interview room in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. Marks is in Bethany Beach, Delaware. Thank you again, sir, for consenting to this interview. And why don't we begin by a brief discussion of your early life, and if you would tell me when and where you were born and where you grew up.
Okay, sir. I was born in a little town called Little Falls, New York, which is in upstate New York, and spent my entire youth in a next town called Herkimer, which not many folks know about. It's on the thruway. That's about its major claim to fame.
Okay. Now, what time period was that?
Pardon?
What time period was that?
Let's see. I was born in 1936 and lived in Herkimer from about 1941 through high school, well, actually through college, which had been
1958. Okay. What was it like growing up there, in a small town, upstate New York?
Super. We had everything you don't have now. Nobody locked their doors. You know, parents never had to worry about where the kids or who they're with or anything like that. It was being in a small town, playing football and basketball and all the sports, and I graduated third in my class. It was like being a big fish in a little pond.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, those are my fondest memories of my life. It was my teenage years, and I have a hard time understanding nowadays why teenagers have so much trouble in their teenage years, because they were my best times.
Well, what size town was this?
About 10,000, I believe.
And about how many people in your high school class?
120, I think, graduated in my senior class.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you enjoyed sports. Did you play in school as well, or was this more neighborhood type sports?
Well, both, but most it was high school sports: football, basketball, and baseball.
Okay. Was there any particular studies that you enjoyed, subjects in high school?
Chemistry and physics.
Hmm.
That's why I went on to college to take up chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you were going through grammar school and perhaps, grammar school, I guess, at the height of the Second World War.
Yes, sir.
What do you remember about that?
I remember when President Roosevelt died, and vaguely that was about it.
Okay. Do you remember your family participating or your neighbors participating in any of the various drives?
Oh, yes, very much so. We had a victory garden in our yard.
Mm-hmm.
Both my parents worked for a newspaper, so my father was exempt from the draft.
Okay.
And I can remember we used to go pick milk pots that they used for parachutes as a kid. And we'd collect aluminum, you know, the old chewing gum wrappers and things of that nature that we give to them for the drives, and metal as well.
Okay. How about any particular rationing that you remember?
Oh, yeah, I still got some cards.
Oh, do you?
My parents, yeah. I still got the gasoline cards and some of the food stamps that they used to have.
Oh, that's remarkable. Okay. Now, you mentioned that your father was exempt as working for a newspaper. Did you have any relatives that did go over and serve in either the Pacific or the Atlantic Theater?
Yeah, my cousin, what the heck was his name now, Eddie Marks, was served over in Guadalcanal.
Wow.
And I remember him coming back, and he was wounded.
Okay.
And talking to him. In fact, he's still alive to this date.
Did he talk much about his experiences?
No, not a great deal.
Okay.
And I had another friend of my father's, Roger Dussault, who was shot down in Germany. He flew B-17s over Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't talk much about it either.
Hmm. Now, were you very inquisitive about it when you saw them? Or?
I tried, yes. Yeah. They, particularly Roger. I didn't see my cousin all that much because he moved away. But Roger, he had an experience. I found out that his airplane was on fire, and I think it was his engineer took his own parachute off and put it on Roger and threw him out of the airplane.
Wow. What happened to the...
The engineer died.
Oh, my goodness.
In fact, they had Roger as a KIA until I went down to the 8th, the Mighty 8th Air Force, and looked him up, and he had him KAI, and I had him change it because he was alive and well last time I saw him.
Oh, my goodness. They mean it, well, how long ago was that you had it changed?
Maybe 5 years ago.
5 years ago, they still had him carried his KIA?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my. Okay. Did you have any other memories of the Second World War? Or perhaps memories or stories that were told to you by your parents or grandparents with regard to the Great Depression and then the Second World War?
The Great Depression, yes, I can remember. We were very poor. Mm-hmm. And my father and mother were both laid off, you know, and it was a hand-to-mouth existence. And really, that's the reason we went to Herkimer, because my father lost his job in Little Falls. I was only 2 years old at the time, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he got a job working for the local Herkimer Evening Telegram. Mm-hmm. And my mother got a job, and he got laid off again, and she kept her job. So she was a breadwinner for quite a while.
Okay. Now, do you have brothers or sisters?
One sister.
Okay.
She lives in Florida.
Was she?
She's 6 years older than I am.
Oh, 6 years older.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, growing up, did you and she share various responsibilities around your house? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, I worked there since I started newspapers when I was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a job either peddling newspapers or I peddled milk.
Hmm.
I remember I did that throughout high school for $7 a week.
Okay. But did you have a strong relationship with your sister growing up?
Yes, right. Okay. She was the toughest kid in the block.
Oh, was she?
Yeah.
Okay.
She used to beat me up to keep in practice.
Okay.
And she's still tough.
Okay. As you were getting close to your graduation from high school, let's see, that would have been...
1954.
1954.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Let's see. Well, some pretty high-profile events were occurring, of course, during your high school years. For those 4 years, the first 4 years of decade of the 1950s. In particular, China had just fallen to communism in 1949.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Korean War broke out in 1950. What do you remember about those major Cold War events?
Nothing.
Okay.
To speak of, Steve.
Okay.
I was, in the clouds at that uh-huh. time. I was only interested in sports and things of that nature
mm-hmm.
and never got involved in thinking mm-hmm. any further than the next football game.
Okay. Now, your parents being reporters, were these types of things discussed much at
very
the
much
table?
So.
Okay.
Very much so.
Yeah.
In fact, I learned all my current events at the dinner table.
Okay.
And I had a funny story. Is when I was in high school, I had an agreement with my social studies teacher, Miss Larkin,
mm-hmm.
that I did not have to pay attention in class as long as I could get above 95 in any test in social studies, which apparently I did because she never bugged me about it. And I learned everything from my father and mother.
Oh, that's funny.
And they didn't even have a high school education at the time.
Your parents didn't?
No.
Wow, when did they get that?
Just on their own, OJT.
Huh. That's amazing. But your social studies teacher would not bother you, and you could daydream or whatever,
mm-hmm.
so long as you got 95.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Could you make arrangements like that with any of your other teachers, or is that the only one?
No, I'd have to say that was the only one.
Okay.
The rest of them maybe told the line pretty well.
Now, the social studies, did that include things like civics?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And current events. And.
Mm-hmm. And you got all that from your parents?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that, of course, some of that was part of your, dinner table conversation. What did they take very much of an active interest in your education as you were growing up?
Not really.
Okay.
I was pretty much left my own devices. They were too busy working all the time.
Okay.
Working two jobs. My father worked two jobs. My mother just one job.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see much of my father.
You mentioned that he worked for the newspaper. What other kind of work did he do?
Did I do it in...
No, your father.
My father?
Mm-hmm.
He was in the National Guard,
mm-hmm.
and it was a sore subject at home because he wanted to go,
mm.
and my mother wouldn't let him.
He wanted to go to
World War II.
To World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What was his? Do you recall what his job in the National Guard was?
He was captain. I think he was executive officer of his company. Okay. It was located in Mohawk, New York.
Was this an infantry company?
Yes.
Wow. Okay. And let's see. Well, as you were nearing your high school graduation, what were your plans? What did you think you were going to go on to, or did you already know?
Oh, I knew. College.
Okay.
It was expected of me. I was going to go become a chemist because that was what I did best.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother took me down to Lehigh University for an interview, and I got accepted as a chemist. But I picked Lehigh because they had an Air Force ROTC program, and I wanted to fly.
Mm. Now, how far back did that dream of yours go, that is the dream of flying?
Grade school.
Okay. Was this based on anything in particular?
No, just you know, I thought it would be the excitement of being a fighter pilot or even a bomber pilot.
Okay. And you mentioned that Lehigh University had Air Force ROTC. Was Lehigh also a land-grant school?
Yes.
So you would have to take at least the first 2 years?
Yeah, I had to take first 2 years of ROTC.
Okay. And so when you graduated in 1954, the following fall, you started at Lehigh?
That's correct.
Okay. And you were a chemistry major?
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you actually graduated with?
Eventually.
Eventually. How long was that?
I graduated in 58, but
that's pretty
I
good.
Was rather immature in all those early years, and I didn't graduate on time. We had the thing called comprehensives, and I failed 5 out of the 6 comprehensives in chemistry. I got the lowest grade they ever recorded in school for physical chemistry, and so they gave me 1 summer to go study. And if I failed the next time around, I had to start a whole new major.
Oh, my.
So I spent the summer studying, and I went back, passed all 5, and then I got one of the highest grades in PChem.
Hmm. Okay. So you graduated in the fall of 58 as opposed to the spring of 58.
Yeah, August, I think it was August,
August.
The 20th of 1958, because I was commissioned the same day and was on active duty 8 days later.
Oh, my. Okay. So as you're going through through college, you made a decision then to stay in ROTC.
Yes.
And what was that dream of flying? What prompted you to do that? You wanted to at least learn how to fly?
Exactly.
Okay. Did you have any aspirations of making the Air Force a career at that point?
Yes.
Oh, okay. What had led you to that conclusion?
I just, flying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in love with the idea of flying.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And now, I didn't really want to be a chemist, to tell you guys that was true.
Okay. Now, did you have any kind of flying experiences prior to going into the Air Force? Had you been on commercial airlines or anything like that?
No, I had never been in an airplane.
Oh, okay. So active duty, late summer of 1958 in the Air Force. Well, actually, before we talk about that, a couple of things about your university experiences. Did you participate in sports there as well?
No, I was too small.
Okay. And
the one thing I did do, though, was a dumb thing, too. I play trumpet.
Okay.
In fact, I've taken it up again after an absence of 45 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried out for the marching band at Lehigh, and was accepted to play first trumpet, and I never showed up after that. So that was one of my more immature moves.
Okay. Now, what do you remember why you didn't?
Not really. Just, I guess, lazy. I didn't want to get involved in a commitment.
Uh-huh. Okay. You mentioned that you were a chemistry major, but you really didn't want to be a chemist. Did you still enjoy the subject and enjoy the classes, or had it started wearing on you?
Oh, no. I enjoyed the classes.
Okay.
I enjoy science a great deal.
Okay.
I just couldn't see myself being a white coat. Mm-hmm. For a career.
Okay. Now, any other subjects pique your interest while you were there at Lehigh?
Ancient history.
Ancient
Roman and Greek history.
Okay. Okay. Now, with regard to your ROTC classes, did they focus on the Second World War as the major air experience that would drive much of what would happen in the Air Force in the near term, in the near future?
No, not really. Not that I remember. It was mostly on leadership and preparing you to be commissioned.
Okay.
They did have, you know, the Air Force history to a degree, but nothing that really sticks in my mind.
Oh, well, the instructors, the Air Force ROTC instructors you had, were they all World War II and Korean War veterans?
They're Korean War veterans, yes.
Okay. Do you recall any particular interesting stories from them?
No, sir.
No?
No. They were pretty straight-laced, and I never got to know them all that well.
Okay. Well, now while you're going through college, of course, the Cold War is continuing to continue to heat up. What do you remember about the contest between the United States and the Soviet Union as it unfolded, and especially, really, the contest between capitalism, free market capitalism, democracy, versus communism?
That they were the bad guys and we were the good guys.
Okay.
Even, I think, at college level, I didn't pay a whole bunch of attention to politics and what was going on throughout the world, other than knowing that if I did get in the Air Force, I would be part of the system, protect the country.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe your initial experiences in the Air Force? Where did, when you left, when you graduated from college and went into the active duty Air Force, where did you go? What were your first impressions?
Okay. I proceeded to Lackland Air Force Base, and I was homesick as all get out. I missed my girlfriend. I went down to pre-flight. I was going to, had been accepted for pilot training, and so went there for a month of you know, getting fitted for uniforms and getting all the flying gear and things of that nature and getting adapted to the Air Force way of life. Like I said, that was at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas, which is the backwater of the world at that time. I really didn't fall in love with the place, and unfortunately I showed up there again, and I taught there eventually. But after that month, I went to Florida in the Panhandle for pilot training, for primary training, and got linked up with, they had civilian instructors. Well, I had an instructor who was the meanest son of a gun you ever saw in your life. He used to carry a broom handle stick, cut off about 18 inches, because we were flying in tandem, and that's what he used to hit you in the back of the helmet with when you messed up. Well, I messed up big time. I was at the top of the class academically and at the bottom in flying, and in 8 hours they put me on what they used to call the wash machine, and so I was out of the program within inside 11 hours. When I finally got the final check ride from a military officer, he said, this is in 1958. He says, you're not all that bad. He says, we can make a pilot out of you. He says, we just don't have time to mess around because we don't need that many pilots now. So that was the story of my flight career.
Oh.
And they asked me, would I go on a navigator training at that time? I said, no way. That was the first time now going back I thought about getting out of the Air Force. So they sent me to Hill Air Force Base as a personnel officer. You know, I was very unhappy. It was to the 460-77th Radar Evaluation Squadron, and I had no idea what I was going to be doing. Fortunately, I had a boss who felt sorry for me and found out that I was a chemist, had knew somebody on base at Hill, and got me assigned to the chem lab. And there I worked for, until, well, this was 58 until 61, I believe. I did a chemist. job, doing repairs on aircraft. I was in charge of all the metal plating and the cleaning processes, these tanks of chemicals and degreasers for the Air Force at Hill.
Okay.
And that's how I got to that part of my life. Then I got married.
And then you got married?
Yeah.
Okay. Was this the same girlfriend you were pining over?
Yes.
Okay. This must have been quite an emotional blow.
It was.
Your dream was to fly.
I was devastated.
But you stayed on in the Air Force.
Yes.
Okay.
I thought about getting out. I came back for interviews for a chemist job. I got hired. They wanted me to go to San Antonio, Texas. I said, hell no, I'm not going to go to San Antonio, Texas. I've been there. I know what it's like down there. So I took a regular commission instead.
Okay.
3 months later, I was transferred to San Antonio, Texas.
Now,
to the officer's training school, where I taught for a couple of years.
Okay. When was that? That was...
Oh, my goodness. Okay. 62 and 63,
mm-hmm.
because I went to to flight training again in 64, to NAV school this time at James Connolly.
Yes, I was going to ask you that. When did you go to NAV school? Okay.
Yeah. I taught an officer training school, the 90-Day Wonders,
mm-hmm.
and I was so disappointed, and most of the guys that taught there were very disappointed. This guy's could cheat, and you could, you know, you'd tell the people you're working for, two of us, the same cheating, they wouldn't do anything to him. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't even throw him out. They commissioned him still. So we were very disenchanted at that time.
And where was this again?
At Lackland. At Autonomous Medina. What is called OTS, Officer
mm-hmm.
Training School.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's still in existence or not.
I believe it is.
Yeah, that's probably how they get people straight out of college.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Now, do you know why they did that? Why they didn't wash them out if they were caught?
They needed to have the numbers.
They were that desperate for bodies?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, wait till we get down the interview further, and I tell you how desperate they were for numbers, what they did to me.
Okay. When was that?
When I went overseas the first time. You know, they stationed us in Macan in the Philippines, even though we're flying to Vietnam all the time, because they had to have that head count outside
mm-hmm.
the country.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What time period was that again?
For when they did this to me?
Mm-hmm.
In 66,
okay.
When I went PCS over there.
When you were flying for?
Yeah, for the TAC Air Command.
For TAC Air Command.
Yeah. If I use those terms like PCS and TDY, am I talking Greek?
Not at all.
Okay.
No, in fact, we'll go ahead and spell out what it is in the transcript when we finish.
Okay.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll definitely come back and talk about that general experience, but I do want to know why or how they mess with you there.
Going back to Lackland, mm-hmm. there was one episode that I remember. It was while I was teaching
mm-hmm.
at Medina. We used to have to pull staff duty officer.
Yes.
And I was on duty the night that the Cuban crisis broke.
Okay.
I had never been so scared in all my life. You know, we're getting the Twixers in, and I had no idea what was happening. Here I am, just a lieutenant. And there's nobody around at all. And so I call my wife up and tell her, pack the car and get out of here, because I have no idea if we'll go to war or not, or, you know, if the Russians are going to start launching
mm-hmm.
Missiles against us. But, you know, who wants to hit Lackland?
They got to hit somewhere.
Yeah, not Lackland, though.
Okay.
That's the backwater of the world.
But, okay, well, that's a very interesting episode to discuss. That's 62, October 62,
yes,
Cuban
right.
Missile Crisis. What did anything else? You mentioned that you received the word that the conflict was emerging.
Mm-hmm.
What did anything else happen there?
No.
At Lackland?
No, not that night. I mean, I was the only one on duty.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't know what to do. I just went around and checked the freezers like I was supposed to.
Okay. Now, during the crisis period, the several weeks of the heightened crisis, did anything happen there? Did anybody get mobilized that you knew of?
No, because it was all training
right.
Where we were.
Okay.
And it was just, you know, teaching the 90-Day Wonders of the new guys to be officers, commissioned officers.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't stop anything that we were doing.
Okay. Do you have any idea where most of those OTS graduates went on to as far as what they did in the Air Force? Was there something in particular that they would be trained for?
Most of them were ground personnel.
Okay.
I don't remember many of them, you know, talking about going into a rated capacity.
Okay. And what did you train? Was this kind of like an accelerated ROTC curriculum
yes.
that you
yes.
you went through?
Yeah.
Okay.
I taught astronautics space. It was a space survey course about rocket engines, you know, how they work and
mm-hmm.
things of that nature.
Okay. And were you chosen to teach those classes based on your chemistry background?
I think so, yeah, because I was one of the few that, that had any kind of scientific background within the cadre of officers that we had there. And I wanted to teach a classroom instead of being one of the officers that acted as a drill instructor. I didn't want that.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that there were some problems with cheating.
Yes.
Were you instructed not to fail students or not to try to wash them out?
Yes.
Wow. Did you...
To ignore it. We were told to ignore it.
Ignore cheating.
Yeah, just stop it, but, you know, ignore it. Break them up or separate them or something like that, but there would be no punitive action.
My goodness.
And that was what caused me to really get the bug to volunteer to go fly again. I was just so fed up with it, I just asked my wife. She said, yeah, you know, go ahead and go fly. Besides, we could use the $100 a month flight pay.
Right. My goodness. Okay. To quickly jump back to your chemist period, you said that was at Hill Air Force Base, is that right? Yeah. The various processes that were used, you mentioned, the various solvents and things of that nature. Was this already pretty much set as far as how to use this material, or were you always under some kind of an evaluation of how it affected the aircraft over the long term and, you know, monitoring to make sure that the chemical components that were being used.
We monitor the chemicals daily because for plating, chrome plating on struts, as for instance, the solution had to be just right or it wouldn't work properly. And there were very dangerous chemicals. You know, it wouldn't pass muster today in today's world with OSHA and things like that of how we worked. Nobody had any masks or... You bound around vapor degreasers, which I even heard of one person falling in one time. You know, he didn't live too long. and we also got involved in designing or improving the operation as well. One thing I can remember is back at that time, the B-58 Hustler was flying, and they had one that crashed in the Salt Lake. And we had to compute, you know, how much weight they had to put on somebody to go down to try to get the pilot out of the aircraft.
Oh, my goodness.
And when they brought them up, I understand. I didn't see it personally, but I understand they look like salt crystals because, you know, they're encased in the salt being so heavy within the salt lake.
Now, the gentleman who you said fell into, I guess this was a degreaser vat or something? What did he die of? Was it chemical pneumonia or something?
I just think it was the asphyxiation from the degreaser. I forget what the chemical composition of it was at the time, but I know they had a cooling level at it, you know, because you could see the vapors maybe about 6 inches to a foot below the top of the tank that make sure they wouldn't get up into the atmosphere.
Oh, my.
But, they, you know, nobody worried about things like that if they even a little bit did spill over.
Do you remember what the chemical composition of the stuff was?
No,
or what it was as far as, you know, like you have various types of stuff now, trichloroethylene and all that stuff.
Yeah, so it was trichloroethylene.
It was?
Yeah.
Wow. That is nasty stuff. Okay. Let's see. Anything else that you remember of interest from that time period when you were a chemist?
No, nothing. Nothing to write home about.
Any changes in how things were done while you were there? For instance,
no, I was what they call an overage at the time. I didn't fill a slot, so they were always getting ready to send us someplace.
I see.
To a new assignment. So, and I think I spent there maybe 2 years, maybe just a little bit more than that, because that's when I got married to Rosie, and our first baby was born, was at Hill. And then I think it was in the winter of 62 is when I was transferred to maybe 61. I'm losing the time frame. I got there in 59. No, it was 61 that I was sent to Medina, which is next door to Lackland.
Right. Okay. Now, just out of curiosity, after that accident where that guy fell in and died, did they institute any kind of new safety precautions or safety program to prevent that kind of accident in the future?
Not back then.
Yeah. It was a different time.
Yeah, a very much different time.
Yeah. Okay. Now, let's see. After you went to Medina, you served there for I guess a little over a year, maybe close to 2 years.
Yeah, until January of '63, because I was in. Yes, in I think it was January or February of 63 is when I went to James Conley, because I graduated in February of 64 from James Conley.
Okay, and this is Navigator's training.
Yeah.
Okay. So that training was close to a year long.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We were well prepared.
Now, what, if you would, could you give me a brief description of what all of that training encompassed? You know, what, how did it begin, and where did it take you?
Okay, I'm probably one of the last, what we used to call, old-time navigators.
Mm-hmm.
That you give them a sextant and a watch, and what we call an HO249, and you can go any place in the world.
Okay.
Because we studied shooting stars, you know, to a great extent. You know.
This is celestial navigation.
It's celestial navigation, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we used that, and Loran A.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Pressure pattern. The absolute altimeter, pressure lines, what we call PLOPs, pressure lines of position, which you give your course line when you're flying, and then you use the sun line to get your speed line for a fix. That would be daylight celestial with pressure, and then you have three star at night.
Okay.
We had grid navigation at the time. Where, you know, you just what we call unslave the compass, and it just use it not in a magnetic manner, but just as a gyro.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're going way back.
Yes, sir. But as you mentioned, you felt when you graduated from navigator training that you were very well prepared.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And the other, we started on radar.
Okay.
That was my first exposure to radar navigation, which made everything easy once you had that radar set.
Right. How? What was the most challenging part of Navigator School for you?
Grid.
How so?
The difficulty of getting used to a different orientation, where you had no north, south, east, or west. You just had a line or a chart that had lines, a grid on it, and you just flew over that grid by flying a heading, and it wasn't even a magnetic heading. You know, it was just a grid heading is what it was. And pilots had difficulty with that, too. Because when you enslave the compass, they have no idea what direction they're going in.
Right. So how long did that grid system remain intact as part of the training, do you know?
We only had it in nav school because when I graduated, I went to 130s right away, and I didn't go up into the Arctic or anything like that in my flight experience, and so we didn't need to use grid, and so, you know, you lost your proficiency.
Okay. So it wasn't something that was practical for your or your.
Oh, no, you don't use it down here in the lower 48, no. You only use it in the Arctic Circle when you're going up to, you know, where everything converges at the pole.
Right. Where a magnetic compass won't work.
Well, it just doesn't work up there.
Right. Okay. After grid, what would you say was the most challenging part of that training for you?
Three star.
Okay. When you went out into the Air Force as an actual navigator, how much celestial navigation did you actually do?
When I was flying the line.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, all the time.
Really?
Oh yes.
Okay.
That was the main way we went over water.
Okay.
For instance, coming back from Hawaii into the States, we used to have a thing called the ADES, Air Defense Designation Zone, and we used to have to hit it within plus or minus 10 miles, or they would launch fighter interceptors against us. And so we were very, I wouldn't say afraid, but attuned that you had to be accurate. Mm-hmm. And using Loran out there in that part of the world, the cuts are not at right angles for the stations, and you know, you get a small error in there, which is a big error in mileage, and so you had to rely on three star, besides maybe getting a couple LOPs from Loran to actually fix yourself. And I almost busted an ADES once, and that's where I became a firm believer of Celestial, because it saved my bacon.
Now,
I didn't believe it at first, then I got a second one 20 minutes later, and it showed I was 150 miles south of course. And I can remember saying, oh, my God, well, I better try it, and I altered into it, and it showed that when we finally got a TACAN lock-on coming into the West Coast, that I had done right.
Based on your Celestial?
Yes.
Okay. Now, how close, how accurate could you be with Celestial navigation with 3-star?
You can get very good. The more you shot, the better you got.
Okay.
I would say you can get down to what we... It's based on a little triangle, and you almost can get that down to a dot when you really get good at it. A plus or minus 10 miles, I would say, would be average.
That's average?
Yeah.
Okay.
And even closer. I mean, if you got if the aircraft was really stable,
okay,
and you were shooting, and you weren't moving around, and the compass wasn't jiggling around, you could get it down to, you could be within a mile or so.
Wow. That's good.
At that time, yeah, it was excellent, because we didn't have GPS or inertial nav systems or anything like that.
Right. Okay. So when you were going through navigator training, when did you know what type of aircraft you would probably be serving on as a navigator?
Not until the very end, when the assignments came out. We had a choice. We could either go to Mather and the B-52s into nav bomb training, or we could go tactical, and I chose tactical.
Okay. Now, during this time period, the time when you were in navigator school, things had been heating up a little bit in Southeast Asia. I guess perhaps just as you were getting to navigator training, of course, President Diem, either it was as you got to navigator training or just before you got there, President Diem was killed. Then, of course, you have President Kennedy's assassination.
Right.
I
was in nav school for that assassination.
For Kennedy?
Right.
What did you think? Well, what was the atmosphere like there at the school when the word came that the president had been killed?
I think that at that time we thought that the Russians had caused it to happen. And that we thought we were actually probably going to end up going to some kind of war with the Soviet Union.
Interesting. What was the overall feeling that you recall with regard to just the general loss of John F. Kennedy as president?
Like the end of the world, really, because he was a young one taking us in a different direction, in a new direction, and he was refreshing. And, people were at a loss for words.
Was it obvious that many of your fellow officers and perhaps even yourself, that you were a supporter of Kennedy?
Yes.
Okay. Was it obvious that many of the other officers were as well?
Sure.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, what did you what were you hearing? What was the information you were receiving there with regard to the American activities and the progressive advisory buildup in Southeast Asia?
Not much, Steve. We were so busy in going through classroom training and flight training that we you had homework to do every night too. Or partying, one or two. So we didn't really pay a whole bunch of attention to what was going on over in Vietnam at that time.
Okay. Well, what did you think of the, as the new president took over, Lyndon Johnson, what was the sense, the feeling there at Navigator School?
I can't say that there was any sense when I was in Nav School. I really didn't, get any kind of feeling about Johnson until I got out and he sent us over to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And, we went over there with the thought that we were going there to win, and it didn't turn out to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I started with so he's a taking replacement. That's the way our system works. So be it. He's now my commander in chief, and I didn't get bad feelings for him until after I got over Vietnam.
Okay. Well, when you left James Connolly, you went
to survival training.
To survival training.
Yeah.
Where was that?
Stead Air Force Base in Nevada. Drove all the way across from New York State with a friend of mine, and measured in hours. And it was right in the dead of winter.
Okay.
And up in the high Sierras up there, and it was awful.
I would imagine.
My God, it was cold, and there was so much snow, and they used to chase us on half tracks. And if they caught you, you punch a ticket. And if you had 10 punches, you had to go through the damn school all over again.
Oh, for crying out loud. And you were on foot, of course.
Yes.
Okay.
And snowshoes.
Oh, my. This is obviously winter survival training.
Mm-hmm. In February.
In February. 1965 or 4?
March of 64. I graduated in February of 64. March of 64.
Okay. What did the survival training involve in terms of, finding food and things of that nature in that environment?
Well, there were two different phases. One, the first phase was the toughest. This is where they taught you about being a POW. And first off, to get you ready, they put you through an obstacle course at night, as cold as it was, and you were wet and dirty, and you got tired just from the obstacle course. And then they brought you in and began to put you into separate cells. And they began to then interrogate you. I can remember I was in line. They stripped you first, made you strip down in the dead of winter. And I was in line, and one of the guys in front of me mouthed off to one of the so-called guards. And he hit him right in the mouth with a rifle butt. Knocked him down, knocked me down, too.
My goodness.
That I recall vividly. Then threw our clothes out into the yard, and we just go out and get them.
Uh-huh.
And then he put us into a cell, which was, you couldn't stand up, you couldn't lay down. They gave you a little can to urinate in. And what they would do, they'd come by and look in, and you had to sound off every time that you came by to assure that you weren't laying down, that you were still awake. And it was just to get you so tired that you would say anything during the interrogations.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would practice putting you into these little boxes. And not practice, they put you in there. Allegedly, I guess there was a medical doctor standing by where they'd squeeze you into a box. Now, I'm not very big. I was only 5'8". But still, it was like being in a CAT scanner. Have you ever been in one of those things?
I haven't, but I understand what you're saying.
Claustrophobic? Okay. Oh, my God. And I heard people, just screaming when they put it in there. They couldn't take it. And you lost your wings if you failed in there.
Mm.
But, everything was, whatever you did, when you did it wrong, you wouldn't stay rated. But, fortunately, I got through that.
How long was that school, the SEER training?
The whole school?
Yeah, the survival training.
It was I want to say 3 weeks.
Okay. That initial
thing. After that phase of it. Oh, then they threw you into a prison yard, like they did in World War II,
mm-hmm.
where you had group survival.
Mm-hmm.
And then you organized and elected a leader, and then they take out the leader and allegedly kill him, stuff like that. Just to get you used to how you had to constantly be going by data rank and things like that, to who was next in command. And taking over and organizing the other
mm-hmm.
people.
Okay, I was just going to ask you. You said elected, but in fact, it was based on data rank, highest rank, data rank, and
It was data rank. That's right.
Okay.
It was strictly a military operation.
Right. Okay. Now, how many men were in this class with you? And I say men as an assumption that this is exclusively.
Yeah, that was
men.
All male.
Okay.
Yeah. Must have been 50 or 60 of us.
At the beginning?
Mm-hmm.
How many men were at the end?
I don't know. When they weeded them out, you never saw them again. So most people made it.
Okay.
I can remember one poor guy who didn't, though, who was with us. He was, an Air National Guard colonel. And he got assigned to myself and another guy on the trek, and he had to stop every 10 minutes, wanted to have a cigarette and stuff like that, and they were chasing us, and we finally said, we can't keep up with you, or you can't keep up with us, and we didn't know what to do, because
mm-hmm.
you're also told, you're not going to leave anybody behind.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, on his own, he just, what you call SIE, or just self-initiated elimination,
mm-hmm.
he walked down the road and left, because he couldn't take it.
Was he that
out of shape?
Or?
Yeah. He was, well, at that time, what was I, 27 or 28,
mm-hmm.
maybe?
Mm-hmm.
and he must have been in his early 40s. Okay. Big difference. I actually came out in better shape out of that experience than I did when I went in. Even when I lost weight and stuff like that, I was tough as nails at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What was the most challenging part of that survival training for you?
Surviving the little box, the little black box. Mm. And then after that, I don't know if this is of any interest.
Mm-hmm.
I went to what is called advanced survival training.
Yeah, I would like to talk about that. Let me I have a few follow-up questions.
Are you aware of that by that term by any chance?
Advanced survival?
Yeah.
No, I'm not. So
have you ever heard it before?
No, I haven't.
There's not a whole lot I can tell you because I imagine it's still classified.
But yeah, I whatever you feel comfortable to talk about, I do want to talk about. But a couple of quick follow-up questions with regard just to survival training itself. You mentioned the physical contact between one of the instructors and
mm-hmm.
The guy that was mouthing off, right
mm-hmm.
on that to the face, to the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Was that common? Was there much physical contact between the instructors and the
It was my understanding, yes. That was the only experience I had. But I do know they would not let any of those instructors go into the officers' club or anything like that. We did not see them on base because I think there was a fear that the students would take after them.
Yeah.
Because I remember this the one guy had a big police dog, and he was just mean.
Hmm.
And the other thing I remember is there was a navigator, but I forget his name, who was shot down, who spent time in a Lubyanka prison. He was a navigator on a B-47 that was flying on the peripheral of the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
God, I can't remember his name right now. And he was one of the instructors, and he was telling us, you know, really, but it's telling us how great he was. But
he spent time in a Russian prison.
Yes. Yeah.
Lubyanka.
Yeah.
Did he tell much about that experience to the class?
Yeah. Yes, he did.
Do you recall much?
That I didn't want to go there.
Okay.
He said, "No, they had a light on all the time and under constant surveillance." And, were treating them as though they were war criminals to start with, not military prisoners. That's mainly what I remember. I remember he's a big mouth, and when I heard him, you know, I said, "My God, he really is full of himself."
Hmm. Okay. How long do you know how long he spent in the Lubyanka prison?
I can hazard a guess that would be measured in months.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow, you know, they traded him for somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any idea what he was doing? Or what they were doing flying so close to the border?
Oh, yeah. They were listening.
Okay. Electronic intelligence?
Yes, electronic eavesdropper. In fact, I just wrote a book about his experiences. In fact... I don't know where the book is right now, but there was a whole book written about that kind of a mission that was flown, not at war, not at peace type of thing, and a lot of them got shot down.
Was this focused on the air war, or using air assets in that respect, or was it just a general espionage?
A quiet espionage thing, where they allegedly were staying outside in international airspace.
Uh-huh.
And probably most of them did, you know, and then the Russians would still come out and go after them.
Yeah. How did he get shot down, do you know?
By MiGs.
Okay.
Up in the, I think, in the Barents Sea.
Mm.
I think that's where they got him.
Mm-hmm. Well, this brings up an interesting issue. What did you think at the time when you learned that he was shot, or did you know at the time that he was shot down under those conditions?
Yes. Yeah, he told us.
What did you think that, you know, here the United States was flying these missions in international airspace, and at the same time the Russians were going into international airspace, shooting them down. The United States was not apparently doing anything overtly to punish the Russians for these violations. And these acts of war, I mean, that's an act of war.
Yep. But we were doing things, too, that we shouldn't be doing. I guess you look at it as this is the choice I made to serve, these are the conditions that I have to expect.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was my view of it.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to get shot down, but
right.
I guess that's goes with the territory.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to fly, flying is a dangerous game.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else? Any other memories, specific memories from that initial survival training? You know, what were you fed, that kind of stuff?
They gave us a small survival packet.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember that it had pemmican in it, which is fatty kind of stuff, and cheese bars.
Mm-hmm.
And I got so hungry, I thought I could eat the cheese bars, because I'm not a cheese eater.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember eating the cheese bars and then just getting sicker than a dog.
Mm-hmm.
And you just lost weight. The biggest problem is getting dehydrated.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it's cold and you're in the snow and things like that, you know, you don't drink.
Mm-hmm.
And your urine gets as dark as can be.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep on trying to instill this into you that you have got to melt snow and drink.
Mm-hmm.
But you get so tired because they're pushing you all the time to see what your endurance is.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys just that, you know. I can remember the last day when you're getting ready, you know, the bus is going to pick you up.
Mm-hmm.
That night, when we woke up the next morning, the guy that I was with, I can remember seeing some of the people laying right in like little creek beds with water running under them. You know, they were so exhausted when they got to the finish point, they just laid down right there and fell asleep.
Okay. Now, the final exercise, I guess, where was the final exercise where you were out, they were chasing you with the half tracks?
Yes. Right. We went out and we had a group camp to begin with for a couple of days where they taught us how to make tents out of our parachute and set snares and things like that to catch, you know, rabbits and whatever. And then after that, that's when they chased us in what they call the escape and evasion phase of it.
Did you make any practical use of the traps and snares they taught you to use?
No.
Okay.
No.
And how long was that chase portion of the training?
About 3 days.
Where you had to evade capture?
Yes.
And was it... Was it just evasion, or what did you have to get from point A to point B?
No. We had to navigate from point A to point B and also evade.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And they knew where all the good spots were.
Did you have a map or anything?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, that's the only way we can navigate.
Right.
Map and a compass.
Mm-hmm.
And then we played games like going to a gorilla's hideout. That's where they gave us some food. That's right. They gave us some soup, something like that, some warm soup.
Okay. So they gave you, like, little pieces of intelligence?
Yes.
That you could act upon?
Right.
Okay. And did it take the full 3 days to get from point A to point B?
It sure did.
Yeah. About how far was it, do you recall?
No. It was up and down mountains.
Okay.
I don't know, you know, how a crow flies, how far it was at all.
Right. But up and down mountains is enough.
Up and down mountains, yeah. Okay. And we were taught, you know, to stay in the tree line so they wouldn't see you.
Mm-hmm.
Those kinds of things.
Okay. Did you travel mostly at night?
Yes. Mostly at night.
All right. Well, when you left, when you passed and left survival training, the initial, and you went on to advanced survival, what was everybody included in that, or
no.
Was there a select group that was
no, just
that?
A select group.
Any idea why you were chosen?
I picked up some skills that would be very handy if I ever became a prisoner.
At advanced survival?
Yes.
Okay. Was this based on organization, communication, things of that nature?
I really can't say too much more because I don't know what the status of the classification is now, and I don't want to get in any trouble.
Okay. All right.
But it was very interesting.
How long did it last?
1 week.
Okay. Good enough. Let's see.
I think one of the reasons that they sent me is because I was on a crew.
Hmm. Okay. When you went to this training, did they give you an indication of its classification?
Only when we got there. We thought we were leaving in 1 day, and they stopped me and said, "You're going to go on to another course."
Okay.
And I said, "Why me?" They said, "Just because you've been selected."
Okay. And they, did they tell you then that, you know, this is, you know, really... secretive training that you'll be receiving, or did you receive that kind of a briefing when you got there?
When we started it. It was that same place. It was at Air Force Base. But
okay. it was an additional week of training.
Yes.
That you went on to that everybody else did not.
Right.
Okay. How many people were included in your group?
I would imagine 10.
Okay. Was this mostly classroom instruction?
Yes.
Okay. And were you told at the time this is top secret, don't ever talk about it?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's, you've certainly piqued my curiosity. I wish I could ask more detailed questions, but oh well.
I wish I could tell you more.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
It was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of, let's see, after that additional week of training, did you know at that point where you were going in terms of your assignments?
Yes, I'd already been assigned to Langley Air Force Base.
Okay.
And C-130s.
Okay. Any particular C-130?
B models.
B models. And for this is the B model for what purpose? What kind of mission?
You call Wee Hall. Right. It was everything.
Okay.
We dropped a lot of troopers
mm-hmm.
out of Fort Bragg
uh-huh.
and out of Pope Air Force Base.
Okay.
Rangers,
uh-huh.
Special Forces.
Okay.
Anything, or haul cargo.
Uh-huh.
Anytime there's a crisis, we had to have a bag packed, and I used to keep one, my B-4 bag, right next to my bed because we had to be in the air 2 hours after we got a phone call.
Wow. Now, let's see. 1964, did you get called into 1965? Did you get called in for any particular missions?
Not until before 1965? No, I was in the process of getting checked out. You know, you're a brand-new navigator. You don't have any line experience. And so the 130 squadron has to really train you in the aircraft systems, low-level navigation, over-water navigation, and things of that nature. Because you don't get exposed to the extent that you have to
uh-huh.
when you're in nav training.
Oh, okay.
But well, we only had two or three over-water missions in nav training.
Okay. Well, you left survival training, advanced survival training, I guess sometime in April
mm-hmm.
of 64.
Mm-hmm. About that time frame.
And then you went on to Langley.
Mm-hmm.
And
proceeded to get checked out in the 130s.
You got checked out. How long did the checkout process last?
I think I got checked out pretty fast. No, I didn't. Because before I was completely checked out, they sent me off to squadron officer school. Which was, what, 6 weeks, something like that, I think, down in Montgomery, Alabama.
Okay.
And then I came back to squadron after SOS and got checked out then. And within about a week of getting checked out, the first time I went to Vietnam.
Okay. What, let's see here. What do you remember most about being checked out in the C-130? What was interesting or challenging about that being a navigator in that particular aircraft?
I'd never gone that fast before. And the reaction, and, you know, with the decisions you had to make and how quick you had to make them. Like if you're shooting what we call an airborne radar approach,
mm-hmm.
an ARA,
mm-hmm.
Where we would talk the pilot down from a given altitude to land, and you had to pick out the runway. You had to give him the right heading to kill drift and set a rate of descent all at the same time. And that took getting used to.
What kind of aircraft had you been and trained in up to that point?
T-29s.
Okay.
The two-engine ones. Now, this one flew, what, twice as fast?
So, yeah, it's a
We would go 300 knots in this one.
Okay. All right, so speed was...
Just the reaction, the overall, you didn't have time to stop and think about it
mm-hmm.
and redo it if you made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't, flying the line, to me anyhow, was different than being in training.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have an instructor that you could fall back on and rely on.
Right.
And you're on your own.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else in particular that you remember that was challenging?
The overwater training. And also the low level of being able to fly, say, 100, 150 feet off the deck
mm-hmm.
And hit checkpoints and be on time.
Mm. When you say on time, within how much of a time frame?
Plus or minus 30 seconds.
Okay. What was most challenging about flying, navigating over water?
I think positioning yourself and knowing where you were,
mm-hmm.
and not having to work so hard.
Right.
You know, when you, as a new navigator, you're busting your butt all the time,
mm-hmm.
and that's how you can tell a new navigator, because he's working 60 minutes out of an hour.
Mm.
And then when you get proficient, you're lucky if you work 20 minutes out of an hour.
Okay.
It's just trying to put everything together: the Loran, the Celestial,
mm-hmm.
ADF, which was, you know, radio,
mm-hmm.
Type thing. All that stuff, climbing out, keeping track of fuel,
mm.
the rate that you're burning off, all those things you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me in the beginning you were trying to do everything all at once.
Okay.
And you had to do all the pre-comps for celestial navigation,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and again in the beginning that takes a little time, looking all the stuff up and making sure you got it right.
Right. Now, as you, when you were navigating over land during the day, or even perhaps in the evenings,
mm-hmm.
And at night, would you use key terrain as well?
At when we're flying at altitude or we're flying at low level?
Either.
At altitude, you fly airways.
Right.
And what we do, you fly with, you ever heard of the term TACAN?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You use a TACAN, you know, give the pilot a heading out of a station,
mm-hmm.
inbound into a station. And I'd call and talk to the centers and, you know, tell them where we are and where we're coming and what's next and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
Low level is completely different at night.
Hmm. What would you do? How would you handle it that way? Low level at night.
Many times they'll put two navigators on an aircraft, one to fly the radar when you're getting down. We flew in the mountains of Virginia,
mm-hmm.
to, and there's a humorous story there too, to practice, because we were getting ready to go over to Europe on a rotation. And I was on a special crew to go and do things that maybe we shouldn't stick our nose into, but drop special forces, let me put it like that.
Okay.
And so we had to practice being below mountains and below radar coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember flying in Virginia where we would be looking up at Ranger Towers at night, and the pilot would turn the landing lights on just to get his attention. If there's a ranger in the tower.
Uh-huh.
That was great fun for us at that time. Or to chase turkeys. Well, I think we killed more turkeys.
You chased turkeys with a C-130?
Yeah.
How would you kill them?
Well, because they panic. You go over a turkey farm at 50 to 100 feet, and they think it's a big buzzard.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, they don't hear you coming.
Right. Okay.
Kids will play.
what unit was this?
463rd, troop carrier wing.
463rd troop carrier wing.
Mm-hmm. At the time, I was in the 773rd TCW troop carrier, TCS squadron, troop carrier squadron.
Okay.
Then they called it the tactical airlift squadron. That's the change. They're always changing names.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see. And was there, you mentioned that you were doing some operations, some training for a rotation to Europe,
mm-hmm.
but I guess that didn't come about.
Eventually it did after I got back from Vietnam.
After your Vietnam service.
Yeah.
Okay. Now when
I was a lead crew, I wasn't a lead crew when I went over to Vietnam.
Uh-huh.
I'm a little getting out of sequence there.
Okay.
Chronologically, it was after I came back.
Oh, okay.
From Vietnam, I became, I was a lead crew over in Vietnam and an instructor,
uh-huh.
but I maintained that status after I got back here and became a special crew,
mm-hmm.
To do things.
Okay, that was...
Drops, special forces.
Special forces stuff. Okay, that was after Vietnam.
Yeah.
Okay. When did you get orders that you were going to Vietnam, and what did you think when you received them?
It was the Gulf of Tonkin. It was the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought that, well, we went over there under a thing called DEFCON 1, which is the war,
mm-hmm.
setting,
mm-hmm.
where everything, all communications between us and anybody in the world was done encrypted,
mm-hmm.
at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought we were going to go to war, and we thought Johnson was sending us over there, and we're going to go win.
Right.
After they, you know, they attacked the destroyers.
Right.
So everybody was gung-ho at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the Philippines and flew out of the Philippines at Clark Air Base.
Okay. And this is August of 64? September?
No, 65. This isn't 65 now.
Oh, this is 65.
Yeah, I think it's about April. Let me look at my logbook.
Sure.
Yeah, my first time over there was 14 April 65.
Okay. So this is part of the initial wave of American service personnel going into Southeast Asia, going into Vietnam.
Yeah, after the advisors type of thing you were talking about earlier,
right.
From the early 60s on, I think we were probably in the first echelon of the big push, and particularly to bring tactile airlift over there to do things with.
Gotcha. Okay. Now,
that's when it was still a daylight war, too.
I'm sorry?
That was when it was still a daylight war, when
okay.
we first started over there.
Okay.
It was like a gentleman's agreement.
Right.
You flew during the daytime, and then everybody quit fighting at night and went downtown.
Okay.
Honest to God, Steve, that's the way it was.
Right.
We were told, now, like in the train, that side belongs to them, this side of the street belongs to you.
Oh, for crying out loud. In the downtown, your train. My goodness. When this was, now in April 65, you went to the Philippines. Then when did you actually, what was your first time in Vietnam?
April 14th.
Okay.
Clark to Benoit. Yeah.
Okay. I was interested in knowing what you thought when you got orders that you go into Vietnam. What did you think the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam, in Southeast Asia?
Stop the old domino effect. You know,
okay.
that South Vietnam fell,
then
Laos and Cambodia, and everybody else would fall just like dominoes.
Okay.
And, you know, one thing I probably should say, too, when I was in the military, I was very apolitical.
It
was just my country, right or wrong, my country. Whatever they told me to do, I went and did.
The domino theory, as you understood it, did that mean that what was happening in Southeast Asia was not necessarily just internal, but was being controlled by someone else?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. That either China or the Soviet Union,
you
know, were providing the emphasis to cause them to institute communistic type governments. We didn't understand that it was nationalism really that was taking place in North Vietnam. And, you know, and unfortunately I hadn't read that much until later in life to find out the Ho Chi Minh and how he was supportive of us during World War II.
Okay. What were your first impressions?
Vietnam?
Yeah, when you left, went over to the Philippines, and then went from the Philippines, Clark Air Force Base, into Vietnam that first time.
It was hot, humid, dirty. Women going to the bathroom right on the street. Men, too. Big piles of garbage. They drove at night with just parking lights on. Nobody don't use any headlamps over there. Those are my very initial impressions. But we'd go to the French restaurants in Saigon. Excellent food. And we'd go and sit on top of the Rex Hotel and watch the firefights at night. Watch the gunships working over the Delta. It was so impersonal.
Well, what was the role that your unit was playing? And was this still the 773?
Yeah, still 73rd. And we were the first, we were hauling in the first ground troops into Vung Tau.
Okay.
Is one of the things that we did.
Okay.
And we were also hauling supplies around the country. And also hauling, or I forget the name of the indigenous people who lived there, up the mountain folks. Remember, they used to come on board with their charcoal fires in their pans, burning, and we'd have to, you know, make him put it out before we would let him in the back of the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
They are of a Chinese extraction, I think, and I can't think of their names right now. But they were good fighters.
So where was this?
The who?
Where? What part of the country was this?
Well, we haul them in different parts of the country.
Okay.
We'd pick them up and take. They fought that way. You know, the men fought and the women went with them, and the kids did too.
Are these the Montagnard forces you're talking about?
No, Montagnard.
What about up in the Highlands?
Yeah, there was something like the Montagnard, but they weren't the Montagnards.
Mm-hmm.
They were Nunks.
Nung?
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, was this near Vung Tau or the coast?
No, this was, we'd haul them any place. I mean, we'd take them to different parts of the country, but that's what we were doing over there, that kind of a mission, mainly hauling supplies and people. I guess like running a passenger service. Or
were these refugees?
No. These are fighters. These are not South Vietnamese army people. These were like guerrillas that the South Vietnamese had enlisted, who disliked, I guess, the Viet Cong even more at that time, because it was a Viet Cong war when we first went over there.
How much action or activity did the units you supported fight against the NVA, to your knowledge, during that first year that you were there?
I don't recall any of it.
Okay.
I don't recall anybody saying anything about the North Vietnamese at that time.
Okay. Now, when you say you were flying all over the country, you literally mean you were flying operations up in the from I Corps up near Hue down to the Mekong Delta, Four Corps?
From Hue all the way down to I don't even remember what the low ones are down there.
Like further south to Canto and Mito.
Yes, Canto. We worked from Canto to Hue.
Wow. Now, how frequent would you fly? How frequently?
Well, every day.
Okay.
We fly 14 hours a day.
My goodness. Now, how frequently would you get shot at as you were flying your missions, your support missions?
Mostly, in the beginning, like I said, it was a daylight war.
Okay.
But really, the first time I got shot at, I think, was when we were PCS over there. That I knew I got shot at because it was at nighttime.
When was that?
Coming in and landing at Saigon.
That first time?
That was the first time I can recall getting shot, because I could look out and see it's coming up, you know, like a garden hose does, but there's just the tracers going across the nose. We're in final landing, the co-pilot froze, and I think I reached over and put the gear down in the flaps for the pilot. We never flew with that guy again.
I was just going to say.
Well, no, he didn't.
That's not good.
We called it quits. He froze.
My goodness. So what happened to him?
I don't know. Nothing that I know of. We just wouldn't fly with them.
So he flew.
You can refuse to fly with somebody who you thought wasn't safe.
So he flew with a different crew after that?
Probably, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Well, this was the first flight into Saigon that you had?
Oh, no. Not that we got shot at?
Yeah.
Oh, no. That was after I'd been there two TDYs and went PCS.
Okay. Yeah, I noticed that the dates that you gave, you were there from April to June of 65. Then
right.
I guess you went back in September and October to December of 65.
Right.
And then you were there again from February...
For a whole year.
For a whole year, February 66 to February 67.
Right.
Okay. So during those first three segments in 1965, April to June, October to December. These were PCSs from Clark?
No.
Or?
This is just TDY. We were TDY from the States at that time.
TDY
to Clark and TDY in country.
Right, temporary duty.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, was there any particular unit you were supporting, or were you just providing support to anyone who asked for it?
Everybody.
Wow.
All the Army, South Vietnamese. In fact, our outfit, I didn't drop troopers myself over there, but our outfit was dropping South Vietnamese troopers.
Mm-hmm.
Funny story about that one was that there was a thunderstorm, and somehow the lead element dropped on time, and the rear element was late dropping, and they pinned in the enemy and had a good firefight and won. But that was just by a mistake.
Okay. Huh. Did you have any kind of weapons on the aircraft yourself?
Just our personal weapons. Okay. The Air Force wouldn't give us weapons at that time. Okay. So I bought a carbine and carried a carbine and a .38.
Hmm. M1 carbine?
Yes.
Okay. The troopers that you're talking about, you dropped, these were South Vietnamese...
South Vietnamese or U.S.
Okay. Did you drop them, parachute drop them?
Yes.
Okay. That's
how they were dropped, yeah. Like I said, I didn't drop them personally on this particular mission. I dropped later on.
Okay. Well, what were your initial impressions of the war and how it was being fought and...
We thought we were winning.
Okay.
You know, we thought it was a typical American feeling. Mm-hmm. We'll get over here, we'll do it quickly, and we'll go home.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't realize about a protracted conflict and the philosophy of the Asiatic compared to the Western.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't realize it was nationalism either. You know, we thought it was communism, and they were really the bad guys, and the South Vietnamese, they'd get some good leadership, and then the army would fight, and we wouldn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
We could just be in a supporting capacity. It didn't turn out that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you talk about differences between Asians and Westerners, and I guess Asians and Americans in particular, could you be more specific?
Well, it's just like World War II or any battles that we get into. We bring everything we have to bear to win right then and there in short order, and we're not prepared for a 10 to 20-year war. We're not prepared to take casualties. And I think, you know, the nightly news bears me out on that one in Vietnam over time.
Mm.
Whereas they are.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were over there for your TDY tours, those two TDY tours, what kind of contact did you have with home? Was it pretty regular?
With who, sir?
With home? With your
home?
Wife?
Mm-hmm.
Family?
Just by mail.
Okay.
It was too expensive that time to call.
And what did you receive any kind of information about how the war was being covered at that time?
Stars and Stripes.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, the Armed Forces network on radio.
Right. But those are inside newspapers, military-controlled newspapers. So their evaluation is always going to be very glowing.
Mm-hmm.
Would you receive any kind of information from your wife or your family?
No.
Okay.
No, they were very supportive, and when we first went over there, I think everybody was supportive, because I remember coming back and speaking to the Chamber of Commerce or Kiwanis Club,
mm-hmm.
that they wanted me to talk about my experiences over the first time I was over there,
mm-hmm.
and very supportive.
Okay.
Nobody was throwing mud at us at that time.
Right. This is early in the war. This wasn't.
Yeah, this is in 65, you know, when we were just getting in there.
Right. Was your wife also... enthusiastic and supportive, or did she have reservations at all?
No reservations whatsoever.
Okay.
She's very supportive. Only my mother was not supportive.
Really?
Yeah.
How did she respond?
Well, she wanted me to get out of the Air Force and get a real job.
Okay. All right. did that position change at all over time, or no?
No.
Okay.
My father was proud of me.
Of course. Okay. Were there any other particular missions for those first two TDY tours that you remember that are particularly memorable?
No, I can't recall anything of any significance during that time. I don't remember if it was at that time, though. We were the first 130 to land after Benoit, after the flight line blew up. They had a whole bunch of B-57s on there, and they had bombs on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the bombs dropped off, blew up the whole flight line.
Oh, goodness.
And I don't remember the time frame, Steve, if it was during the TDY or what it was. It was during one of the TDYs, because I remember I was still flying with a guy by the name of Hillier at that time.
Okay.
And that we carried the bodies out from that one. I mean,
oh,
it was kind of gruesome. That it was a mess when we landed.
Now, you mentioned... in the questionnaire, that the C-130 Bravos that you guys were flying, and these were basically good for any kind of mission from air
anything.
Air evacuation to bombing.
Everything.
Did you during those first TDY tours, did you do just about everything? Did you guys do any kind of bombing? Or?
No.
Okay.
No, that was later in the war.
Okay.
That, in fact, that was my unit was doing that subsequent to my leaving Vietnam.
Okay. How about the using it for an air evacuation?
Did a lot of them.
Okay. Then when you say air evac, you're talking about picking up guys from one of the field hospitals or one of the evacuation hospitals and taking
them? Or both.
They're
picking them up right in the field and flying them to the field hospitals.
You that, being the first?
That's probably the best mission I ever flew in my life, but that was best later in time.
But, oh, that was during your year?
Yeah, that was during my year, toward the end of my year.
So let's go ahead and talk about it while we're talking about it. This is a mission where you actually flew into a landing zone?
Well, we were at, it happened on December 2nd, 1966.
Okay.
We were flying a passenger run, which is making many stops throughout Vietnam, and we're at a place called Pleiku, up in the highlands. And we're getting ready to take off. We were supposed to go to Quy Nhon, but the weather was so crummy that they were going to cancel us, and we were going back toward Nha Trang. And as we were, the pilot and I, was, his name is Don Silvey, and as we were standing outside the aircraft, an Army person came up and said that, I think it was a doctor, I think he was the first one to come up and said, you know, they just had a young trooper who had gotten a head wound, a very serious head wound, and asked if we could take him out of there. We said, yeah, we can take him back to Saigon. And it'd be an hour and 10 minutes or something like that. And he said he won't live that long. So the pilot and I talked it over. We said, well, what the heck? Why don't we go over to Quy Nhon anyhow and see what happens, because this kid's not going to live anyhow. So Quy Nhon is about 15 minutes away. And we took off out of there and got over to Quy Nhon, which is on the coast. They had a big field hospital there. And they knew that we were going to try to get in there. I think they'd called ahead, you know, for an operating room. And I shot. Remember, I told you about airborne radar approaches. Well, the only thing they had going to Quy Nhon was a thing called an ADF approach, and that the minimums there are 3,000 feet in elevation or height, and 3 miles forward visibility. When you go below that, you go below what they call minimums. And that was, you know, the field was a lot less than that. So I shot an ARA, took him down to, I think, around 100 feet over the water. And I can remember we're coming in through the harbor, and this thing, it's like a funnel, Steve, that with mountains that go in toward like a V with a little exit way there. But once you get in there, you're committed. You know, you can't get back out of there. And we weren't powerful enough to climb out of there. And I remember seeing the ships in the harbor, because it did off a lot of unloading over there at that particular port. It was a big offload port, too. And I remember the pilot pulling up and going over the top of the ships and then back down toward the water again. And I flew him right over the end of the runway. He never saw it. And I had him shoot what is called the closed pattern. And he just yanked that thing around, and then he saw it on the second pass. And we landed, and came to stop. They came out and got the young guy. I wish I knew if he ever lived or not. But this all took place in 25 minutes.
Wow.
And we were so nervous we couldn't light a cigarette after that. That was when I was still smoking. We were the only aircraft from what the tower told us to land there that day or take off.
25 minutes. That's pretty good. But you never were able to find out if you lived or died.
No. It was just another day in the office, really, for us. And they didn't know whether to give us a medal or what. But we had 60 people on board, and they claimed that we risked everybody's life to save one, and so they decided to do nothing. Typical government.
Okay.
But if it were the same way today, I'd do the same thing again, because at least we gave the kid a chance.
Yeah. When you did this, when you were flying this mission, how much were you getting fired at?
No, the weather was so bad, there was nothing.
There was nothing?
No. We were the only plane that could land, airplane that landed there that day.
My goodness.
In fact, the tower sort of laughed at us when we asked for takeoff clearance. I mean, we were, you know, minimums, like I said, 3,000 and 3 miles. We were down to, in feet, 100 feet, something like that, where the ceiling was. So we took a very big risk.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never done it before, and I've never done it since.
Okay.
In my flying career.
Okay. Was this a judgment call that the aircraft commander had to make?
Yes.
To do
he
it?
He trusted me.
Okay.
Because actually what it was is my ability to let down through all that stuff and mm-hmm. find the runway.
Mm-hmm.
But he and I had an excellent relationship.
Okay. Well, let's get back to your TDY tours real quick.
Okay.
The period between June of 65 and October of 65,
mm-hmm.
when you left your first TDY tour and came back for your second, what did you do during that four-month period?
Flew on the Dominican Republic thing.
Okay. Yeah, the Dominican Republic crisis.
Right.
Yeah. What did you guys do down there?
Well, we went in to drop troops.
Mm-hmm.
But they called us off at the last second. Mm-hmm. We never ended up dropping. We ended up landing them.
Okay. How long did you spend in the Dominican Republic?
I think about a week.
Mm-hmm. Anything interesting happen while you were there?
No.
No?
No. We could just see where some of the old P-51s have been sitting down there and somebody shot them up, and they were burning a little bit, but, you know, nothing to write home about.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's see. Well, that wasn't very much time, then.
Oh, no.
What else did you do during that four-month
period?
Just
normal missions.
Normal missions?
Practice, yeah, train.
Were these all at Langley?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anything in particular that... that you were trained on specifically for returning to Vietnam for your second TDY?
No.
Okay. And what took you back for your second TDY?
I think just our turn at a rotation going over there because
mm-hmm.
they didn't have that many 130s
mm-hmm.
and everybody had a shot in the barrel
mm-hmm.
At that time, so I think our number came up again. They were talking at that time about sending us PCS, but we figured as long as they're sending us TDY, they wouldn't do that. You know, little did we know.
Mm-hmm.
When they brought us back home the next time, we had PCS orders when we landed.
Okay. Was there much difference in your... when you went back October of 65, was there very much difference when you
no.
got there from your first TDY?
Not noticeable, no.
Okay. Any difference in the missions you were flying?
No.
Okay.
Just more of them.
Okay. So increased tempo?
Yeah, we started flying more at night, too,
mm.
at that time. Like I said before, in the beginning... it was pretty much a daylight type of war. Everything
mm-hmm.
shut down at night.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't really worry about getting shot at that much when you're on the ground. You know, you just didn't get bothered.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, that's when you started, you know, they had to put the screens on the buses, as I remember, for mm-hmm. people, women or kids, to pitch hand grenades at you.
Mm-hmm.
No, they never did that to me. So, you know, but that's what they told us would happen if we weren't careful.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much interaction... during the TDY tours in 65, how much interaction did you have with Vietnamese people?
Not much. Well, bar girls.
Okay.
And and the people downtown.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was very impersonal. There was nothing, no friendships or anything like that were established.
How were you treated by the Vietnamese people?
Indifferently.
Mm-hmm. Were there... were you given any specific instructions or briefings on how to conduct yourself while in Vietnam with regard to culture, customs, rules, you know, laws, anything like that?
No.
Okay. Did you receive any kind of briefing at all for your in-country?
Just don't exchange your dollars on the black market system for piastres,
okay.
which everybody did anyhow.
Okay. And was that so you could get more for your
yeah,
dollar?
Right.
Get more piastres.
Right.
Okay.
We were the only ones that were allowed to bring real money into the country. I think that by that time they'd started that, you know, the military GI kind of money,
mm-hmm,
the funny money.
Yeah. The military script.
Yeah, script, because we were going in and out, so, you know, they didn't make us turn all of our green over.
Oh, okay.
Some people took advantage of the system.
Mm-hmm.
Most people didn't.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you able to, or were you allowed to buy things and take them back with you?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay.
But I don't think we ever did. I never purchased anything in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. We'd purchase when we went to Thailand or something like that, or up to Taiwan.
Mm, okay.
I don't think that we felt that they had anything in Vietnam that we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty dirty.
Mm. Well, what were your impressions about the when you were providing support to the Vietnamese guerrilla forces, or the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, what were your impressions of them and how they were conducting themselves in this war?
I think the enlisted guys were scared to death,
mm-hmm.
and the officers were incompetent in the main. You know, I did not have that much interaction with them because we were just hauling them around primarily, mm-hmm. but what we saw wasn't impressive.
And, let's see, did you do any kind of refugee relocation that you know of?
You mean taking them out of the country?
No. I mean, for instance, if there was fighting in a particular area and refugees resulted as a result of the combat and the fighting, people who would be dislocated have to be relocated someplace else in Vietnam.
No. Steve, I don't think that kind of stuff was done.
Okay.
Not unless there was some connection to the government or some reason to do it. If the average person over there, I don't think that they really cared too much for or about what happened to them.
Okay.
At least I never saw anything like that.
Okay. 1965. You left December 1st, I guess, to go back to the United States again?
Yeah, I don't know what the exact time was. I'm looking here.
Mm-hmm.
4 December. Is the date I have that we left
Clark
for Tachikawa.
Okay. Actually, something I forgot to ask about your TDY tours. What did you guys do for food, lodging, quarters? You know, when you're flying throughout the country like you are, did you have a specific fixed base that you did operate out of?
Yes.
You would always come back to?
Saigon.
You always flew out of
Every
Saigon?
Every night you came back to Saigon, and we either lived downtown in a hotel,
uh-huh.
or we lived in a place called Cholan,
mm-hmm.
where the government had a hotel.
Okay. Now, when you say you lived in downtown Saigon in a hotel, does that mean that you actually paid for it yourselves?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah, we were on our own to go find them after
mm-hmm.
we got there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main kind of interaction that we would have with the Vietnamese, is just trying to locate a hotel to stay at that had, you know, hot water.
Mm-hmm. The government-run hotel in Cholon, was that a nice place to stay, or?
No, not really. I mean, it was adequate.
Adequate.
There was a place to sleep, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a long, long drive from Tan Sanut down to Cholon.
Okay.
And one time we even got trapped in there. You know, the Viet Cong had an attack, and we all got trapped inside the hotel, and the army had to come and rescue us.
Did anybody get injured or?
No, no.
Or hurt?
Huh. No.
How big of a firefight was there when the Army got there?
I didn't see much of anything.
Mm-hmm. Did you hear much?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of noise going on
out
there. But we were on the upper floors, and we stayed out of harm's way.
Okay.
We're basically cowards.
Well, I wouldn't say that. The When you say the Army, are you talking about the Vietnamese Army or American?
No, American.
American Army came and rescued you. Okay.
Any
other interesting hostage or other situations emerged while you were there?
During my TDYs?
Mm-hmm.
No. When we weren't there, we would be at Clark Air Base, and we had a house there. And they put several of our crews together in one house.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the main, you asked, what did we do? We played hearts.
Okay.
To see who had to do dishes at night.
Okay. let's see. Well, what did you do for recreation in Vietnam besides watch the firefights from the balcony of the...
Drink.
Okay.
You didn't have time to do much recreation.
Yeah.
That was sort of a... You did that if you got back to Clark.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, were you able to take... your wife and, I guess, your children at this point, they're staying in Virginia, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, when you left in December of 65 to go back and your PCS orders were sitting there waiting for you, what did you think at that point?
I was mad as a hornet.
Were you?
Oh, you bet.
Why?
Hell, I didn't want to go back there PCS.
Yeah.
They were going to send me back to Clark to begin with. I was going to have to take my wife and family over there. The war was beginning to heat up, and I didn't want to take my wife and family over there and then have me get shot.
Mm-hmm.
Because we started losing people at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And the day that we got in line, what we call the processing line, to get out,
mm-hmm.
or to go PCS,
mm-hmm.
the guy in front of me, I started talking to him and convinced him, well, why doesn't he take my assignment at Clark and I'll take his at Mactan Island, which is in the southern Philippines, and I can go remote and get out of there in 12 months instead of going there for 18 months.
Hmm. He agreed to do that?
He agreed, yeah. He eventually ended up taking his family over.
Okay, and you did. You went over?
I went over by myself, yeah.
By yourself, your wife,
mm-hmm.
and children?
Yeah, because that way I could get it done quicker.
Okay. And but your mission didn't change as a result of that?
No.
Or
no.
Your actual assignment?
No.
Okay. Well, what were your family's impressions about you having to go over for a full year?
Oh, they didn't like it either.
Yeah.
I had to move them up to Herkimer, New York, where we were from.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife has always been supportive of me in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And she understood,
mm-hmm.
and she felt that it was, you know, it's just part of her duty,
mm-hmm.
to be supportive.
Mm-hmm.
I've been very fortunate like that.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Married to the same woman for 43 years.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, in what was the nation, what was happening in the nation at all changing from your perspective about how the war was being conducted and how people were approaching the war?
You know, I don't think that it had really changed at the time. Because remember, now I'm early on. In 66,
mm-hmm.
I'm over the PCS.
Right.
And it was just beginning to build. The North Vietnamese at that time were really just getting into the fray.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't have that many casualties yet.
Yeah. Did you hear anything about any kind of student demonstrations up to this point?
No.
That you recall?
No.
Okay. Well, when you went back for your... for the second tour, now this is an extended PCS move, basically. It's going to be a year tour.
Mm-hmm.
What, did you have to go through any kind of additional preparation for your second, for this tour versus the first TDY tours?
No, we were all qualified at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I've considered a very professional organization. I changed squadrons at them when I went through the processing line. I went from the 73rd to the 772nd, the Little Red Foxes is the name of that squadron.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Mactan Island, and lo and behold, they put us up in palatial tents. And we ate out of mess kits and cleaned our mess kits and immersion the heaters in garbage cans.
Oh, goodness. So you left in February of 66, and what was your support mission? What were you briefed on as far as what you would be doing as a primary mission?
The same type of thing.
That you did for the TDY.
Yeah.
Okay. When you got back to Vietnam for your PCS, you mentioned that one of the noticeable differences is obviously the North Vietnamese are getting more into the fight.
Yes.
Any other major changes, differences that you noticed from your TDYs?
Yeah, we're getting more into the bigger operations. You know, I don't remember all the names of them. I remember something like Operation Birmingham,
mm-hmm.
Squire.
Mm-hmm.
We were landing at some godforsaken places, sometimes on neoprene strips that they just laid down, you know, and cut a spot out for us to land in the jungle. Chio Rio was one of the places I remember the name of because I saw in my logbook today. But we were still flying all over the country. We were coming in now for landings at a steeper angle of approach because they were shooting more. And that was just standard operating procedure, that, you know, that they would, you would land and reverse the props in the air to drop that big thing down just as hard as you could,
mm-hmm.
as quick as you could.
Okay.
And it wasn't just a daylight war anymore. I remember where they used to park some of our aircraft out by the bomb dump.
Mm-hmm.
We were getting attacked. We got attacked up there one night and got pinned down. But, you know, nothing came of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we just went on and flew the missions that we were assigned. But it, you could see the changes then. It was no longer, this is your side of the street, this is my side of the street.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that, I guess more pilots, more crews were getting shot at, more crews were getting shot down, more
yes.
casualties were occurring.
Yes. Right, even in our own organization. I can remember talking to a friend of mine who was in the 74th.
Mm-hmm.
20 minutes later, he's dead. He got hit at play coup.
Mm-hmm.
The whole airplane went in.
Did he have passengers on board?
No, I think they're just carrying cargo. That's mostly what we did. Most of us didn't care for the passenger runs to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
We'd rather just, you know, haul the cargo.
Okay. When you say cargo, you're talking about
everything.
Everything from equipment to food to munitions to weapons, everything.
One mission that I don't know if it's of interest or not.
Mm-hmm.
We were coming back after having flown for I think about 14 hours, and we're by Pleiku,
mm-hmm.
and we got called. They extended our crew duty day.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted us to land at Pleiku, which we did, and we picked up a load of ammunition, and we took it into a place called Ducto 2.
Okay.
And there was a firefight going on as we landed. But before we landed, when we got in contact with the ground there, they told us that the second half of the dirt runway had aircraft on it. We only had the first half to land on. There were no landing lights.
Mm-hmm.
So they put two Jeeps out, got on the approach end of the runway, and we came in there, and it was, again, in the mountains. It's a very mountainous country.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to make several loops around to the pilot could find out the end of the runway, and then he put it down. And as soon as we got down, and we didn't even shut down, and the Army guys were coming on board, breaking open the ammunition boxes, loading their weapons, going out and fighting.
My goodness.
And I think that... You know, I heard the story that, I don't know if you ever heard of the Lonesome M from West Point, Carpenter was his name.
No.
I think that was the same battle that he allegedly called down the artillery onto himself I know he got some big medal out of it, but I'm not, you know, that's just hearsay on my part.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you flew into a place like that, did you get shot at pretty hard?
Never got hit.
Never got hit.
So I don't know if we got shot at or not. No, the only place time I ever got hit was landing in Detroit during after Martin Luther King died during the riots.
Wait, your entire
time never
time
got hit.
In Southeast Asia, your aircraft never got hit.
Never got hit.
Now that's remarkable.
I was even when we went into Khe Sanh. I don't know. I think he may have probably heard of Khe Sanh.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
When did you guys fly?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we flew resupply into them.
In 1966?
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, we used to take in the big gun barrels to them.
Wow.
I remember that mission in particular.
Mm-hmm.
The great big 155-millimeter howitzers, replacement barrels, we'd fly them into them. But we would land one way and take off in the same direction so
mm-hmm.
that, or the opposite direction, so, you know, you'd reduce the amount of gunfire that you'd get
mm-hmm.
attract to you.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever carry any vehicles, C-130?
Vehicles?
Yeah, can it accommodate some of the smaller vehicles?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we can carry the pretty good-sized truck. Oh, that's an interesting mission, too. You're talking about vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the name of the field goal, but it was a little dirt strip. They had a road grader in there that they had been using.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to get one of the big lift helicopters to take it out, and it must have been the weather was so hot that he couldn't get the lift to take it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so we flew around on this particular mission until we only had about 15 minutes worth of fuel left because it wasn't too far we had to take it.
Mm-hmm.
They just couldn't get out of there. And we landed in this dirt strip. I got out of the airplane, and I took a look at number one engine and number four engine were over the sides of the runway. There was not enough runway,
mm-hmm.
and it was muddy. I remember the mud was almost up to the hubcaps of the wheels, and I looked at the end of the runway, and there's this great big tree. And I was playing with a guy, this guy by the name of Hillier, and he said, I can make it. And I said, George, I'm going to go with you one time, but if you don't, I'm going to get off on this thing. And he did. That road grader took up the entire back end of the airplane. They just got it in there.
Wow.
And we got, I think it was about 25 or 30,000 pound piece of equipment that we carried out of there. And I think we took it back to Benoit, which is about 15 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we carried all kinds of things.
Now, during your TDY tours and during your PCS tour, were there any problems with the supply system in getting what you needed?
Oh, yeah. What we needed or what the people in the country needed?
Either or.
Well,
both.
Yeah. You could find all the beer that you wanted,
uh-huh.
but you couldn't find soda, soda pop to drink. Mm-hmm. So what we used, and soap. So what we used to do is bring in soda pop and soap and trade it to the guys at some of these little outposts
mm-hmm.
in some of the special forces camps. We'd land there, and they'd give us steaks or something like that that we could take back with us to grill out.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd give them those kind of things.
And so these were the supply problems that the soldiers in Southeast Asia were facing.
Right.
What about for Air Force stuff?
A lot of times, unless you were going to fly an air vac mission, most of the times the air conditioning system on the aircraft didn't work.
Okay.
But you always had to have it, and that was why it was nice to fly air vac missions, particularly if you're going to take them back to Clark,
mm-hmm.
is you had an aircraft that was cool. And those little things start meaning things if you've been there for a while.
Yeah. Now, was this just because you didn't have the proper... repair,
they didn't have the parts.
Replacement parts?
Yeah.
To repair the
sure.
air conditioning systems?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
That's just, one small example.
Well, that's a pretty big one because it gets awfully hot there.
It was very hot.
And you're in an enclosed aircraft.
Yeah, but and you learn to live with it. And a lot of times, we ate sea rations.
Mm-hmm.
That was our mainstay over there, particularly when you're working.
Mm-hmm.
That was all you had. There was no place to get food. For us,
uh-huh.
for the crews.
So you ate most of the sea rations?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Have eaten a lot of sea rations.
Now, for your PCS tour, where were you based out of?
Mactan Island, Philippines, which is in the southern Philippines,
mm-hmm.
right near the island of Cebu.
But
we were the first Americans that mm-hmm. they had seen since the liberation of the Japanese.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
How was the reception?
Super. Didn't get ruined until after we'd been there for a while.
Okay. But you mean you every day you'd fly back there?
No. We'd still go to Saigon.
Okay.
At that time, we would fly in-country for 14 days at a WAC.
Okay.
And then we'd go back for maintenance to Mactan mm-hmm. for 72 hours, and we'd get R&R. They'd send us downtown to a hotel so we could rest up a little bit
okay.
before we'd be sent back in-country again.
Okay.
And they did this to keep the numbers of people that were actually being accounted against in Vietnam down.
Okay, this is when you were talking earlier about how
yes.
this manpower issue affected you later.
Right.
Okay. Because when you're talking about the manpower issues, the manpower number in Vietnam, I mean, by 1966, we've committed quite a few.
We committed more than what actually the numbers showed, though.
We on paper we said we only had,
so many thousands, but then we had all of us who were stationed outside of the theater of operations, but actually flying in the theater of operations.
Right.
You see, the TDYs don't count.
Right. So you were PCS to Mactan Island.
Yes.
And TDY to Vietnam.
Right.
Again.
Right.
So your whole second your year tour was a TDY tour in Vietnam again.
Right.
Oh, that's. I see what you're saying now. Yeah, that's really interesting. So on paper we had only committed about 150,000, 200,000 troops. In fact, when you take all the support personnel like yourself, we had quite a few more in there.
Sure, you had a whole wing of 130s. They were flying either out of Clark Field or out of Mactan.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Well, you mentioned the air conditioning. You would go back every 2 weeks
mm-hmm.
For maintenance and other things. You mentioned the air conditioning system as a maintenance problem. Any other major maintenance issues?
No, none that really stick in my mind. Of course, the engines had to work all the time.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine the internal supply system focused on making sure of that.
Mm-hmm.
Air conditioning.
We used to break down a lot, though. I can remember,
really?
You know, we would be going, we'd fly from Mactown, go up to Clark, to say, to pick up a load, mm-hmm. and go in country.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd break down up there, and we'd sit on a ramp up there while they tried to find a part for 8-10 hours at a whack.
Hmm. Now, were these random things or anything in particular?
No, well, see, I'm not in maintenance. I never was in maintenance, so I never
okay.
was well-versed in what the particular part was.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even hazard, you know, a good example.
Okay. But it would delay you.
Yes.
And but the delays would not be in the days. It would be in the hours.
Sometimes it would be in days.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What would you do? If it was into the days.
Well, then he'd find a place for us to stay at Clark, and, mm-hmm. and we'd just stay there. And that didn't bother us.
No, they wouldn't find you a replacement aircraft to just jump in and take
they
off?
Didn't, most of the time, they didn't have replacement aircraft.
Okay.
We were pretty well committed.
Okay. What was your impression of the C-130 itself as an aircraft for the types of missions you were flying?
Oh, super.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the C-47 by any chance?
Yes, I am.
Well, the 130 is the same category.
Mm-hmm.
It's a forgiving aircraft. It can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
They use it for a gunship. They use it to drop bombs. They mm-hmm. use it for, like I said, air evac, passengers. You name it, and that aircraft can do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you guys do much air delivery where you wouldn't actually land? You just let cargo out the back as you're on approach with using chutes?
We practiced it.
Okay.
They were coming up with a new aerial delivery system called, what was it, PLADS? I'm going back so far now, see if I can't remember what the acronym for it
mm-hmm.
was. Where, yes, we would drop things out of the back end. Most of the time, the kinds of offloads we did
mm-hmm.
would be rapid offloads where we would actually touch down and land with a fast taxi back, particularly at fields. When it's getting toward dusk, we didn't know who had control of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I and the loadmaster would go, because we had what is called a 463L pallet system. It was on rollers.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just roll the ammunition and stuff out right off the end of the ramp and just let it go gabang
mm-hmm.
on the taxiway.
Mm-hmm.
And we would never stop. We would not come to a complete stop and just turn around and take off again.
Okay. And when, the system, I would imagine, that was developed ensured that material wouldn't be too damaged.
Oh, for dropping?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I've done a lot of dropping, mm-hmm. and most of the stuff gets to the ground okay.
Okay. And you would do this with no matter what kind of material you had?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like the type of landing that you just described where you would just let the material out of the back cargo area without stopping and then just take it right back off?
Right.
Any kind of equipment?
Anything. Oh, yeah, even up, including ammunition, you know, and it's about a 6 to 7 foot drop from the back of the ramp to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And we always wondered, you know, are you going to set anything off? We
yeah.
never did.
Okay. Did you, during your second TDY into Vietnam, PCS to the Philippines, did you go on any kind of bombing runs? Did you guys
no.
actually drop anything?
No.
Okay. And, what would you estimate or guess was the heaviest weapon fired upon you by the enemy, by the North Vietnamese?
I guess I would say probably 37 millimeter.
Okay. It never got hit?
Nope.
That's amazing.
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. Did you guys ever lose any engines?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Any significant events involving engine failures?
No, but there are a couple of interesting stories.
Yeah,
about
go ahead.
Engines.
Yeah.
When we were coming home from
mm-hmm.
TDY,
mm-hmm.
it was not uncommon when something would go wrong in an engine and we'd shut it down in flight and then we'd start it up just as we landed at Hickam so everything looks okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next morning when we took off back for the States, we started all four engines back up again, take off and shut it down. We got the altitude and fly into the States on three engines.
Now, but obviously you weren't supposed to do this, right?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
No. But you wanted to get home.
I was just going to say, but if you didn't do it this way, the aircraft would be grounded and you'd be stuck there.
You'd have to wait until somebody had an engine change or figured out what was wrong with it.
Right.
And hell, after you've been there for a few months, you're ready to get home.
Yeah. Now, this particular type of manipulation of your aircraft, was this during your first two TDYs or the second portion?
No, this was during the TDYs because PCS, you know, you wouldn't do that
when
you're PCS.
Right,
no.
Okay.
And there was one other one. Let's see. Oh, we used to go up to Kadena every now and then, which was a plush assignment if you got it, and sit nuclear alert, which they would load your planes with the nuke weapons, and then if you lost an engine, you'd have to take off on three engines to get out of Kadena Air Base to go to Korea or wherever your destination was.
Mm-hmm.
So that was told, you will take off on three engines.
Mm-hmm. One of the few exceptions to that rule.
Yeah, because, that's a war rule.
Yeah, and you've got nuclear weapons on board.
Right.
Now, were these the nuclear weapons you're delivering for future deployment elsewhere, or are you going to be dropping them?
No, somebody else would drop them.
Okay.
We were just we haul.
Yeah, okay, you were delivering them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Huh. How many times did you get up to Kadena for that kind of duty?
I think I got that mission twice.
Okay.
And it was nice because you got to stay at the pool, and we were there for maybe 3 or 4 days at a whack, and the only thing you had to do is they'd have a drill every now and then. You had to run down the airplane, get the engine started, and I think you had something like 10 minutes gone.
From the time the drill started?
Yeah, from the time that they blew the whistle.
Wow. That's not a lot of time to get from the pool to the aircraft.
After you've been on a crew, things go fast.
Okay.
You have almost like a silent checklist. You know the capabilities of every member of that crew.
Uh-huh. And you know the capabilities of the aircraft.
Yes.
Okay. Now, would these be pre-plotted
destinations?
Yeah, destinations and missions. So you yourself as a navigator wouldn't have to sit there and try to evaluate the best route and the appropriate
unless you hit weather, then it's up to you. You know, you got to go around weather.
Gotcha. But you can always get off the ground and continue to plan that, correct?
Yeah, well, that's when you do it.
Okay.
The flight plan is only good until you get the wheels in the well.
Okay.
And then you got to play it by ear.
Okay. Now, how would you address those issues? How would you address weather as a problem? Would you get consistent updates on weather and potentially along your flight path?
No. Okay. You're on your own.
Oh. Okay.
Your radar set is your main. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, we've been coming back from missions before from Vietnam where our radar wasn't working, and we'd join up with another aircraft, and he would fly us through the weather.
Okay.
We're used to flying 5 seconds in trail.
Mm-hmm. You mean 5 seconds behind a lead aircraft?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Or even sometimes in the situation. If it's really bad weather, you tuck your nose right up under his tail and just follow him visually.
When you say tuck your nose under his tail, how close?
As close as the pilot felt comfortable sticking it up there. I mean, you're talking feet.
Feet?
Feet. Inches.
What? Okay.
I mean, maybe 3 feet sometimes.
My goodness.
It used to scare the heck out of me. I can remember... when we used to do that as a routine measure of the way we flew formation, I used to just stand in the window and just watch him and watch the tail of the aircraft above me.
Mm-hmm. Now, wasn't there any concern? I guess it was just there's no fear because if turbulence is going to affect one aircraft, it's going to affect both?
No, yeah, but no, there's, yeah. You better make sure you got a good pilot. there are good pilots and there are old pilots. Or bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots.
Okay. All right.
I was fortunate, Steve. I flew with some very good people, very professional.
Obviously.
In fact, at that era, in the early part of the war, you had the most competent 130 crews ever.
Okay. Now, what kind of contact were you having with home during your PCS to the Philippines?
Just letters. I'd write to my wife every day, and she'd write to me.
Okay. Now, did you also have access, since you were routinely going back to the Philippines, did you also have access to non-military news sources, you know, magazines, news magazines like Newsweek, Time, US
yeah,
news?
But we never read that stuff.
You never did?
No.
Okay.
The only thing we did, we drank a lot.
Okay. Now, was this just to help pass the time? Was it to help deal with stress?
Yes.
Combination?
Yes.
Okay. What was?
It was getting to the point you didn't know for sure, you know, if somebody might have your number.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so you didn't plan too far ahead.
How many aircraft and crews were lost from your particular squadron?
Squadron? At the time I was over there, I think we lost two.
Okay.
But after that, they lost a lot more.
Yeah.
When you got into the late 60s, early 70s time frame, mm-hmm. you know, when Quezon was being surrounded,
mm-hmm.
and that's when we started really taking the hits.
Okay. And you said you did provide some relief. Wait, no, are you talking about Quezon in 68?
No, I'm talking Quezon later. You know, we went
yeah.
to Quezon early on, not
right.
when it was under siege.
Right. Okay. You're talking about the later.
Yes.
Quezon
that's when
siege.
That's when our
right.
Wings started taking
losing
many more hits.
Okay. For the time that you were there for that PCS in the Philippines and your missions in Vietnam at that point, did you notice any change progressively over the course of that year? In terms of how the war was being fought, how things were going, and did you feel that, or did your attitude about the war change at all over the course of that year?
Big time.
How so?
Why did we ever come over there?
Hmm.
And we started, you know, the mission I hated the most was carrying the body bags out, and we did that more and more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that the casualties were building up, and we just knew that we weren't winning. We knew that they were better fighters than what they had ever told us that they were going to be, particularly the North Vietnamese. And even the fighter strikes. I used to fly a mission called Hillsboro, where we'd go up and control fighter strikes. We would fly over Laos and control the fighters over North Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even at that time, then you started getting the SAMs. You know, you could actually hear the guys talking about SAMs being launched against them.
Mm-hmm. Was this... When you're talking about taking the body bags out, where were you taking them?
We'd pick them up in the field and take them to Benoit or someplace like that, you know, for mortuary services.
Okay.
And the darn things leak.
Oh, goodness.
And the smell is horrific.
You didn't pick them up from Vietnam and take them out of Vietnam?
No. They prepared them before they took them out of Vietnam.
Yeah.
If they came out of Vietnam, they'd be in aluminum caskets.
In the aluminum caskets, right.
Yeah, and that's how we carried them too, back to Clark.
Okay, so you did do the remains evacuation as well.
Yes.
The repatriation.
Right.
Okay. And then from Clark, they were loaded onto larger aircraft, taken back to the United States?
Probably.
Yeah. Okay. How did that affect you, that particular duty in dealing with the body bags and the remains? Of American soldiers.
Like I said, I didn't like it, and we saw it more and more, you know, that there were KIs, because we used to have to call them in
mm-hmm.
when you're flying, and it got to be more and more all the time, you know, how many are you carrying, 17 bodies this time?
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be, you used to put them on stretchers, and the way we could rig for carrying, like, an air evac mission,
mm-hmm.
and then it got so many sometimes, you just stack them in.
My goodness.
On the floor.
Okay. What were the other more challenging missions that you flew as your second, your PCS tour came to an end? Any other challenges?
I'm trying to think. No, like I say, I live a charmed life. I can't think of anything noteworthy.
Okay. Anything else from your PCS tour that you would like to discuss today that you can remember?
From the PCS tour?
Mm-hmm.
When I got back, I got sent to develop some special dropping procedures and they asked me to go back and volunteer to do the mission.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, I wouldn't go. Because at that time, my wife didn't want me to go back. You know, that's the time that all hell was breaking loose back here.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out what we were doing is on McNamara had some kind of a line over there where they had sensors, and they were also trying to make the trail slippery and wet.
Mm-hmm.
And this powder that we were dropping was that. It was some kind of a material to exacerbate rains when they turn everything into a quagmire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found one of the loadmasters who wrote a book about our experiences that I have in 130s talked to this guy. I think his name is Butterworth. Went over and flew that mission and allegedly really got shot up quite bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just thankful I never went back.
Yeah. But when you were coming to the end of that tour in February of 1967,
mm-hmm.
did you think that the United States was going to accomplish its mission and goals?
No. But mainly, I just wanted to get home. I'd had enough of it, and that's somebody else's turn. But no, I think that we all felt at that time, what a waste.
Did you talk much about it with other flight personnel?
No.
Okay. It just wasn't something you guys talked about?
Yeah, it's just something you didn't really talk about.
Yeah. When you got back to the United States, had much changed over the course of that year? When you left in February of 66, came back February 67, was there much change that you could tell in the country itself?
Yeah, I don't remember exactly when Kent State happened, the time frame, but it wasn't... We're in the same time period. Those kinds of things are starting to take place. And you would see it on television every night, the people who were against the war. And you'd hear McNamara talk and Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And America send my boys or the American boys when your boys can fight. And it was a big lie.
Mm. So would you? What was the credibility of our government in your eyes at that point? How much credibility did the Johnson administration?
Zero. That's when I started to really become anti-Johnson, anti-war, and anti-McNamara.
Okay.
And I didn't want any part of it anymore.
When you came back, what was your assignment?
Back to Langley.
Okay. Same issue.
Then I started flying over in Europe.
Okay. When did you go to Europe?
In, I think, October of 67.
Again, flying C-130s?
Mm-hmm. I was flying E-models this time.
E-models. These are electronic eavesdropping aircraft?
No. They're just a little, carry more cargo, and they got different kinds of...
Oh, it's a large... Okay.
Same mission,
essentially. Same mission, okay.
Went over to Mildenhall and flew out of there.
Did you ever fly any of the Special Operations C-130s? Whether it be an E-model
or second, that's why I retired, is they were going to send me to gunships.
Oh.
And I said, no, I'll see you.
That
was after my tour in the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Okay. These are the Spectre gunships?
Yes.
Okay. So, Europe in 1967. This is an accompanied or unaccompanied tour?
No, it was just TDY again.
Oh, just TDY?
That's the kind of flying they do with tactical airlift.
Okay.
Is you have an operating base back here in the States, and they just send you out TDY all the time.
Hmm. How long were you in Europe?
3 months, until Christmas time of that year.
What was the atmosphere like in Europe that you could tell with regard to the Vietnam War? How were Europeans responding to it?
I don't even remember anybody talking about it.
Okay. Where in Europe were you?
All over. Germany, Berlin, Munich, Greece, Athens, which is a great place. I think that was the time. Wasn't it 6 days war? About 9? We had the mission of taking out the remains of what was left in Jordan of the 104s that the Israelis had bombed in Jordan.
Okay.
And what else? Oh, it's a great place. I enjoyed Europe.
Mm-hmm. But you, as far as like news coverage of Vietnam and other stuff concerning Vietnam, you didn't see much about Vietnam there?
No.
Okay.
If I did, Steve, I didn't pay any attention to it.
Yeah.
I figured, you know, my war was over with, and this is good stuff now.
Mm. And the missions you were flying in Europe, these were pretty much just hauling materiel to
yes.
and from places.
Yeah, okay. Right.
Very much troop transport there?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How about special operations drops, like you were talking
well,
about?
We did some of them because I was a special crew, but it, you know, it wasn't special ops like you think about it today,
yeah, okay.
where they have the outfits that are just geared to special ops.
Right.
We did this as a side mission.
Gotcha. Okay.
And we made drops and went places that weren't supposed to, that kind of stuff.
Okay. And when you came back in December of 67, where did you go from there?
I came down with hepatitis.
Oh, boy.
No, I flew one more time. We went over to Korea. There was something that took place over in Korea, and we had to make an emergency run over there. Because I remember when we went back to Tachikawa and crew rest, I was just beat. Even after we'd had 24 hours, I was still tired. When I came back, I got grounded for hepatitis. And that really essentially ended my flying career. Oh, I didn't tell you, though. I did get bit by a rat in the Philippines. I had to go through the rabies series.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You got bit by a rat?
Yeah. Well, I was sleeping one night.
And they made you go through the stomach
well,
shot series?
Yeah, they told me I have a choice.
You can either
do that or take a chance of dying.
And that was how many shots?
14. And there is one humorous incident I must relate to you about being stationed in MACTAN. See, it was a well-kept secret. We found out later on that some of the fighter jocks from Vietnam who were stationed over there used to come to MACTAN because we had such a good time over there in MACTAN and raised so much hell. We had a place that we called, now don't get angry at me, it's a base gym / whorehouse.
Okay.
It was a house of 50 prostitutes. And there was a competition between the U.S.-based commander and the Filipino-based commander who was going to have the coke concession. And so the American commander put up a fence right along where the American property was, and the base gym, / whorehouse, was on the other side of it. And it was off-limits to all of us. Well, I used to hang around with two big guys, much bigger than me. And we decided one night, well, we're going to go there.
Mm-hmm.
So we snuck around. And they had the APs on the American side. But we snuck around through the Filipino side and gotten back there. And we're going through the backyard, and there was this big old water buffalo. We had been drinking, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to these big two guys, I'll bet you can't throw that water buffalo on his back. And they decided, well, I bet you we can. And so they did. And he was one unhappy camper. I thought he was going to kill all three of us when he got up.
Mm-hmm.
So, but we snuck into the base gym, and then we went outside and started thumbing our noses and giving cat calls to the Americans on the other side. Here we are with 50 prostitutes surrounding us. And we're the only Americans in the place now because it's off limits. So we went back in there and spent the night drinking with the girls, and then we left quietly.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the kind of stuff we did in our off time.
I see. So this house of ill repute, this was operated by the Filipinos.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. For the pure pleasure of Americans.
Now, but the fence was put up because of a competition over a Coca-Cola concession?
Yeah, right. Who's going to have the Coke concession? Strange things happen.
You aren't kidding. It was because the American base commander wanted the Coca-Cola concession?
He wanted us to get a fair shake. See, the Filipino commander was going to take us to the cleaners and Cokes.
Uh-huh.
And the American commander said no. And said, if you do that, I'll put it off limits to you.
Otherwise, if he had been fair in the prices he had for Coca-Cola,
it
would have been okay for American personnel to go into the base gym / whorehouse.
Oh, sure. I mean, that was the big thing over there. And we spent just about every night over there.
Okay. Before the fence went up.
Yeah.
Now, how far into your tour did the fence go up?
Oh, this is right toward the end.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I got in a lot of trouble at that time. And
how so?
Oh, I just did crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I sprayed the base commander with a water hose one night in the club. And I got banned from the club for a while. And the squadron commander the day I left put me on the airplane and said, "Don't you ever come back."
This did not adversely affect your military career?
Oh, no, no.
My goodness.
That was completely different. I mean, this is...
Yeah, it's a different time.
Yeah. It was a different time. Oh, that stuff wouldn't cut the mustard now.
No.
Not at all.
Yeah. Now, were there any female Air Force personnel serving with you over there?
No. Nary a one.
Okay.
Except in Vietnam. They had the nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very popular.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Some of them came home quite rich.
How so?
Well, I'll let you figure that one out, pal.
Well, you brought it up. I was going to make you say it. Okay. Now, do you think that was just rumor, or do you think that's true?
No, that's true.
Okay. But certainly only for a minority.
Oh, sure,
very small,
of course.
Okay. Let's see. Any other interesting or humorous stories about your PCS tour to the Philippines and TDY to Vietnam?
No, that's about it.
Okay.
You
know,
I led a sheltered life.
Okay. Was there any particular or significant lesson or lessons that you took away from your service, your time in Southeast Asia that was important for you later?
Yes. And having read more about on the subject, you know, like The Best and the Brightest,
mm-hmm.
and a few other books along those lines,
mm-hmm.
what the philosophy is today that Colin Powell has.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to go to war, we go to win. And you get the country behind. This is what scares me right now about Iraq.
Mm.
I mean, I'm dead set against what Bush has in mind, you know, personally,
mm-hmm.
because I don't think he can pull the country along,
mm-hmm.
and I don't want to see another Vietnam.
Okay.
And that's for sure, to me, what will happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to fight, do it to win.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, don't go.
Okay. When you got back to the United States, you went on to your European tour, you came back. You came down with hepatitis. That what strain of hepatitis?
A.
Okay. That you said that ended your flying career.
At that time, yes.
Now,
it ended my flying tactically. I did get back on status later on.
How long?
I flew generals after that.
For how long did it ruin your, or did it remove you from flying? Flying period, and why would it remove you completely from flying tactically? Do you know?
Well, there's a story behind that.
Okay.
When I was in the hospital, my squadron commander came up and said, "How long before you can be back in the air?" And I said, "My God, here I am in the hospital, and the only thing you can think about is put me back in an airplane right away." When I got out of the hospital, I talked to my wife, and she said, "Well, maybe it's time to quit." You know, I wasn't that far from retirement at that time, but I thought seriously about quitting. So I went to the wing commander.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "No, sir, I want to get out. I've had it. The only thing that the squadron commander could think of was not how am I doing, but how soon could he put me back in an airplane?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well," he said, "you got a pretty good reason." He said, "If I can find you something else to do, we just think about staying."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Yeah." So he got me a job in headquarters TAC, beginning to develop war plans using a computer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a whole other career that I undertook then. And then I went from Tactical Air Command up to Headquarters Air Force in war planning,
mm-hmm.
and then to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where I headed up the Crisis Action System, and which led to, after I retired, the kind of work I was doing for continuity of government. You know, if something bad happens, how do you reestablish government?
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote plans like that as a private contractor for until 1995,
mm-hmm.
retired, And I just got called back again now as a consultant for the same company, and I'm working, evaluating state and local government's ability to handle nuclear power accidents or things of that nature.
What company is that?
System Planning Corporation was a company that I worked for and did all, wrote all the plans for FEMA. That was very hush-hush, very highly classified. My clearance to start at the top secret went up. That, you know, the unclassified portion of it is continuity to government about reestablishing government if you were to have a nuclear war.
Okay. Basically starting from the ground up.
Yeah, what's left? You know,
yeah,
what's left, what can you save? Yeah. Or how can you hide government? You know, what can you do to have continuity within the United States so you don't fall apart as a nation state? It was interesting work. It was heady times.
Sounds like it. What, when you were working in developing war plans, were there any particular scenarios that you can discuss? Was this European theater stuff? Was this limited war?
Most of it that I did was what I say crisis action system, the small kinds of wars.
Okay.
What would happen in Grenada or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is normally you just write war plans and you put them on a shelf.
Mm-hmm.
But the minute you publish a thing, they're out of date.
Mm-hmm.
The problem was, how do you update these things rapidly to the then current situation with the forces that are ready right now?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I used to work in, is coming up with force, what they call force deployment capabilities that would match what was needed, either by the involved the Marines, Air Force, Army, Navy type of thing. The force packages is... what the nickname of the stuff, or the moniker that we went under.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun.
Did were any of these used?
You know, yes, they were in a sense. This predated the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on a thing called the WIMIX, which is the Worldwide... Interconnected computers. I forget. I remember the nickname was WIMIX.
Mm-hmm.
It was the precursor of the Internet, which was using packet switching for the first time, if you're familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you lost a node in communications, you know, you could go 100 different ways, but you wouldn't lose the information.
Right.
And that was the forerunner of the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing that. We were using computers to write plans using that capability, particularly in a limited war type of environment. But you reviewed all your plans. Even all your big plans were done with the same way. You know, they were all being generated over the computer, and all the logistics and stuff like that was being put into computers so you would be able to rapidly change things in the 11th hour.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you work on the war planning side of things?
From when I was grounded in 67,
mm-hmm.
at the end of 67,
mm-hmm.
until I retired in 79.
Okay. And during the early part of 68, of course, as you were recovering from hepatitis, I imagine, of course, Tet hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, March of 68, Johnson makes the declaration, the bombing halt, temporary partial bombing halt, and he's not going to seek re-election. You know, things aren't looking very good.
No.
What were you thinking? What did you hear? What were you thinking at the time, how the war was progressing at that point?
I think we were just trying to, how do you want to call it, fish or cut and run.
Mm.
You know, I didn't think we were going to have the staying power to help the Vietnamese anymore. I felt that we were whipped.
Hmm. What was morale like?
Awful.
At that time, in 68?
Not good at all.
Hmm.
Everybody else had the same, not everybody, most people had the same perception.
Hmm.
And, you know, I look at people like Colin Powell, and then you find out this later on, as he begins to talk now, how they felt when... He was my contemporary. We were the same rank for a while.
Okay. When Nixon was elected, Well, first of all, did you? What did you think of Nixon?
He's a crook, but I thought he was very good in foreign policy.
Okay. Now, in 1968, as far as the crook part, you're talking about later.
Yeah.
Right, with Watergate and all that. But when he was running for election?
I was
in 1968.
For him. Yeah, I was all for him because I thought if anybody's going to do anything, he would be the kind of guy that would.
Mm-hmm. And what was your impression of his policy when he did get into office, and the peace with honor, the Vietnamization?
Well, after a while, you figured it out. It was nothing but words.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that we were going to cut and run.
Yeah. Okay. And when that did happen, after we got the Paris Peace Accord signed in 1973, and we got the POWs back in 1973, of course, Vietnam fell April of 1975. What did you think?
Thank God it's over.
Okay.
That's the first war we lost, and I was on watch at that time.
Mm-hmm. How did that affect you in terms of your life? You know, what life experience, life change did it bring about for you?
I don't think it did.
Okay.
Change my life in any way. I was happy to be home, be
mm-hmm.
my family.
Mm-hmm.
I had a whole new life now.
Mm-hmm.
I was just sorry for what we did. But I also blame the high-ranking officers, too, for not standing up to Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And even to Nixon, you know, even to resign or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was built on a foundation of lies.
Mm-hmm. As you were working in the war planning, and you worked in headquarters, you mentioned headquarters Air Force for the Joint Chiefs. Well, I guess for the headquarters Air Force, you were doing the same thing, the war planning, is that correct?
Yes.
And then for the Joint Chiefs?
Crisis action for them.
The crisis action.
Mm-hmm.
How were you, is there any way you can explain how you were applying your lessons, the things you learned from Vietnam into these scenarios, into this this activity?
I don't think so, Steve, because
okay.
I was so far down the line.
Okay.
You know, I didn't, I was not a decision maker
mm-hmm.
or in any authoritative position.
I see.
I was a doer.
Okay. Did you get the feeling or the sense that positive lessons were being taken from the negative experiences of Vietnam and incorporated into our new policies and planning?
No, not at that time.
Okay.
That was later on. I didn't really begin to see that mm-hmm. until the Gulf War time frame.
Okay.
On my small scale, we could make inroads by trying to show the generals that there's a better way of doing war planning,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you can get a more accurate description of what you need and when you need it and how long it's going to take you to get there.
Okay.
Just a better way to deploy forces.
Okay.
And I worked on the Mayaguez.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing I worked on was the Jonestown's massacre.
What kind of work did you do for that?
I was on the JCS staff, and
mm-hmm.
so I got to be in the crisis action team,
mm-hmm.
and we used a lot of the stuff that I developed
mm-hmm.
for coming up with a force structure, even if you're going to go send transport planes someplace, you
mm-hmm.
know, in the supporting tail that goes with them.
Mm-hmm.
Say to go pick up the bodies,
okay.
type of thing. And Mayaguez was to
mm-hmm.
Get the forces over there to.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, I'm sorry. To get the forces over to the.
Yeah, to the area
mm-hmm.
so that they could execute whatever provisions, you know, they were going to implement.
Okay. After you left the Air Force in 79, and you
mm-hmm.
you worked for the private contractor,
mm-hmm.
How similar was your work for the contractor in that respect?
Quite similar, because it was planning. My first one, I worked for a place called Data Design Laboratories, and I worked in the Ground Launch Cruise Missile project.
Mm-hmm.
I was the chief scheduler
mm-hmm.
for the building of the Ground Launch Cruise Missile for the program manager, who was in the Air Force, and I was a civilian, but I sort of worked hand in glove with him
mm-hmm.
in ordering what we call long lead items,
mm-hmm.
things that take 2 years to build to get in. And I used to draw all the schedules for putting it together to get an end item.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then from there I went on to SPC, mm-hmm. and because of my planning experience, FEMA mm-hmm. wanted me to help them write what was called Family of Plans, where you have the supported plan and then everybody built a supporting plan and they all supposed to mesh. They mm-hmm. didn't have that expertise, if you will, mm-hmm. at that time, so mm-hmm. I came in and helped them do some of that.
And this was the nuclear disaster type of planning?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I got involved in hurricanes, mm-hmm. earthquakes.
Hmm. How about other the possibility of having to deal with a crisis dealing with other weapons of mass destruction, as we call them today, whether it be chemical or biological?
Uh-huh.
Same thing?
You'd have to follow the same process. It doesn't matter mm-hmm. which weapons you're going to be. You take like a nuclear accident or chemical or biological.
Mm-hmm.
It's how soon can you get the people mm-hmm. out of the immediate area? Like what we do right now is a 10-mile radius around the power plant.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going over to evaluate a place called Calvert Cliffs at the beginning of September.
Mm-hmm.
We work at what they call the State Emergency Operations Centers, and you have the counties,
mm-hmm.
and you just watch what they do, and then you critique them, and you try to help them improve on what they're doing in the time it takes to do it in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they're good. I mean, I'm amazed. The lower you go in our governmental rungs, the more proficient and efficient they are.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get the bureaucracy until you get to the county and state level. That's the politics that starts entering in.
Now, I was intrigued by your discussion earlier with regard to the planning to rebuild government given certain situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering at the time, and I don't know if you could discuss this, but at the time of the planning that you were involved in, how prevalent, how prominent were computers? They were just coming in.
Just really beginning to come in.
Were they being factored into one of the technical means that could be used to assist in that process?
Yeah. We were trying every way we could to use computers.
Okay.
I'm talking now in the terms of the IBM 1401. Do you remember how old? Are you old enough to remember that kind of stuff?
What, the punch card type computers?
Yes, the punch card.
Oh,
you could drop the tray of cards, everything's out of order?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's when we first started with that vintage machine
mm-hmm.
to do war planning.
Okay.
And then as we got more capabilities, then it became easier and easier, particularly as you started going to higher level languages like COBOL
mm-hmm.
and beyond those languages.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, and right now, I think war planning is totally... So I've been out of it for so long, though, but I would imagine it's totally dependent on your computer capability. You pull the plug and you probably got big time problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to discuss today?
No, sir. I can't think of anything.
Okay. I think we've covered pretty much all of your important experiences. If you were to describe what you think is the most important lesson we should take away from our Vietnam War experience, what would it be?
Don't go in if you don't have primary interest. And you're not going to win. If you're going to commit American forces, commit to win or don't commit at all.
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and put an official ending onto this interview. Thank you very much. This will end our interview with Richard Marks.
Thank you.